Good morning, everyone. I'd like to thank you all for joining today and welcome you to Fannie Mae's first and hopefully last virtual rating agency day. I'm Laurel Davis. I head the Connecticut Avenue Securities Program here at Fannie Mae. I think I know most of you on the line, and so I'd like to say on behalf of all my colleagues, we're glad that you're able to join us virtually today, but we do very much miss the opportunity to see all of you in person, and so hopefully we'll have that chance again sometime soon. I also want to start by mentioning that as the situation around COVID-19 continues to evolve, we recognize these are very unusual times, to say the least. And so first and foremost, our thoughts are with you, your employees, and your families. At Fannie Mae, we've put policies in place to help keep our people healthy and keep our business open so that we can deliver for our customers, the housing market, and the broader economy. The goal of today is to provide you, our rating agencies, and dealer partners with transparency and insight into how we manage credit risk on our single-family book. This is intended to complement the significant amount of information and data that we provide on our web pages and through our ongoing meetings that we have with you, have had with you over the past several years in support of our Connecticut Avenue Securities Program. Also, given the pressing nature of the COVID-19 crisis, we've layered in discussions throughout the day that will address how we're responding in various areas across the business. And to that end, I think the main theme that you'll hear throughout the day is that our response to COVID-19 has largely been able to draw upon the array of policies we've put into place since the housing crisis to help mitigate losses, as well as many of the digital advances that we've focused on and have shared with you in recent years. So I'm pleased that we'll be joined by senior management across our single family business today who will provide you with more details and expert insights into their processes. Before we get started, just a couple of things to remind folks of. I do want to remind participants that Fannie Mae is currently in a quiet period in advance of our Q2 2020 10Q filing. So we're unable to comment on current, past, or future financial performance or results. In addition, nothing that our employees say here today about housing, the mortgage market, or Fannie Mae should be taken to mean anything about Fannie Mae's future financial performance or results. A few housekeeping items. Number one, this call may be recorded for Fannie Mae for business purposes. By participating in a recorded call, you consent to being recorded. If you do not wish to be recorded, please do not participate in the call. Secondly, we recommend that you click on the web page every so often, as the Deal Roadshow platform will close out the presentation if there has not been activity on the page for 15 minutes due to security measures. If you are logged out of the platform, simply log back in using the code FMAE2020. Thirdly, the operator will remind the audience how to ask questions during the Q&A portion of each segment. If there are questions from rating agencies that cannot be addressed in this forum, we will follow up with you via 17G5. And again, that goes back to the issue that we are in a quiet period. And so there may be some questions we are unable to comment on in this forum. And finally, I would like to remind you about the event microsite. It's available via the link on the Deal Roadshow platform, where you can view today's agenda and presentation, speaker bios, video demos of our tools, and submit questions. It is password protected, and the login and password is included in the email that was sent to registrants. So with that, I would like to wrap up, and I'm very pleased to be able to turn the program over to Celeste Brown, Fannie Mae's Chief Financial Officer, who will give us opening remarks. Thank you, and over to Celeste.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us virtually. You know, it's been really interesting for me. I have four kids at home, trying to get all the work done and homeschooling and keeping kids out of trouble and, you know, trying to have a little bit of a normal life. I was finally able to take some time off last week and feel a little bit more human. But we have, you know, we have quite a bit to do here just given our role in housing finance and, you know, the ability for us to provide some relief to so many people out there who have lost their jobs or are struggling financially. So, you know, we are focused on working with our partners who support homeowners and renters through the challenges. And, you know, we are looking to do what we can to help the nation work through the impact of the pandemic. We're also very focused on ensuring that we're best prepared to serve the market's future needs. I'm really excited about our future and look forward to the opportunities and challenges ahead. Hopefully not a lot of new surprises in 2020, but, you know, so far 2020 has added quite a bit on the, both the opportunity and the challenge side for us. So our strategic plan contains three objectives, and these are things that we expect to remain in place for several years. We have a three-year plan. We're in the first year. The first is to ensure that we are a return-oriented company that is able to attract private capital while managing risk to the company in the housing finance system. The second is to increase operational agility and accelerate our digital transformation to deliver more value to our customers and the broader housing finance system. And we really saw the need for this over the last few months, just given the, you know, everyone going virtual. The last is to build on our mission-oriented activities to become a globally recognized top-performing environmental, social, and governance, or ESG, financial services company by delivering positive mission and community outcomes with our stakeholders. And given the recent focus on systemic racism and social injustice, we believe we are in a very strong position to continue to lead on this front. We've had some notable accomplishments related to our objectives, and I'll address them in reverse order. The future we envision is one where we lead in the ESG responsibilities that are expected of today's leading company. As Hugh Frater says, it is by our charter and our choice that we are a purpose-driven company. We were recently recognized by the Climate Bonds Green Bond Pioneer Awards as the largest 10-year global issuer for our multifamily green bonds program. And in fact, we just added a position here of a VP of climate risk and policy to enhance our positioning and focus on climate risk. We're doing more in the single family green space as well, and we'll talk about that more in the coming months. Our Home Ready mortgage program allows us to increase economic diversity of borrowers through low down payment options available to creditworthy low-income first-time and repeat buyers. In our Access program, members of whom support our CAS program and are on the line today, seeks to ensure we are expanding our business model to include diverse security dealers with the aim of providing more investors across our offerings. We also continue to advance our digital transformation. We invested heavily in our digital transformation over the last several years that allowed us to drive far more agility into our organization, both from how our policies are created to how those get implemented at the digital product level. And these investments have paid off during the current crisis. In fact, because of these investments, we were able to make changes to our offerings for those exiting forbearance and get them in place in a timely manner so that it would be broadly available to the market. We're leveraging technology to move faster, become more productive, and stay connected. In the current climate, amidst the coronavirus, we're working together to rediscover the best ways to conduct business, and we're relying on more digital capabilities than ever. And you'll hear more about these efforts throughout the agenda. Stakeholders like rating agencies are critical feedback providers on our digital transformation efforts. You all provide an important independent lens of your view into how these advances impact our ability to manage risk. And last but not least, we recently announced that we hired an underwriting financial advisor to assist in developing and implementing a plan for recapitalizing the company and responsibly ending conservatorship. They will work closely with us, the FHFA, and Treasury to consider business and capital structures, market impacts and timing, and available capital raising alternatives, among other items. While we work with our advisor on planning for recapitalizing the company, we're also further examining FHFA's proposed rulemaking for a new regulatory capital framework for Fannie Mae. We continue to be focused on supporting the existing CRT market, of which rating agencies and our dealer partners play such a critical role. That's why events like these and transparent dialogue with all are so important and fundamental to how we do business. Thank you for your time, and I'll turn it back to Laurel to kick off today's session.
Great. Thank you, Celeste. And so I would like to now turn the program over to Malloy Evans and Cindy Danko, who will speak to our credit risk management strategy and credit policy and acquisitions. So with that, I will turn it over to Malloy and Cindy. Thank you.
Thanks, Laurel.
Oh, excuse me.
And
sorry, Malloy.
Yeah, go ahead, Laurel.
It's Laurel. I'm sorry. I just realized. My apologies. I was supposed to actually introduce you guys with your titles. So sorry for that little bobble there. But let me do a little bit more formal introduction. So let me welcome Malloy Evans, who is our Senior Vice President and Chief Credit Officer for Single Family, and Cindy Danko is our Vice President of Single Family Credit Risk Management. And so with that, I will turn it over to Malloy and Cindy. My apologies.
Great. Thanks, Laurel. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining. Sorry we can't be in person, but to echo Laurel and Celeste earlier, hope all of you are staying safe and learning how to manage or have learned how to manage through kind of crisis mentality and working from home and all that brings. You know, I was joking earlier with the internal team that I fully expect my dog to continue her very avid protection of the house from the mailman during my remarks. So apologies in advance if she does her job. But again, thank you all for joining. This is important for us to make sure that, you know, we are able to share with you all our credit risk management strategy and how we are managing risk, not only for ourselves, but for our credit risk investor base, which is an important base for us, as Celeste just mentioned. Our objective in the single family risk management organization is really to ensure that the partners that we do business with and the loans that we acquire fit within our risk appetite and support sustainable home ownership. That sustainability concept and lens is really what drives how we set our appetite. We want to make sure that we are providing liquidity and support for loans that we think are going to be successful and for borrowers who are going to be able to succeed in those mortgages. I think we learned the hard way, I guess is a good way to say it, right, of what happens when you don't have that lens on sustainability. And it doesn't do the borrower any good. It doesn't do their neighborhood or community any good, and it certainly doesn't do Fannie Mae or our investor base any good. So we have certainly maintained that lens on sustainable home ownership since the end of the or since the crisis started back in 2008, before the prior crisis. After acquisition, we certainly focus on managing those loans as well as our servicers to support continued performance and to minimize our loss realization. And we understand that these responsibilities are a key component in successfully delivering on the strategic objectives that Celeste just described, really in all three categories, right? So the risks that we take and how we manage them certainly have a direct impact on our capital management, but we are also kind of a key partner in our digital transformation and wanting to make sure that effort actually leads us to better risk management outcomes. And then on the ESG front, the affordable mission has long been a core component of who we are as Fannie Mae. And again, with that lens on sustainability, we want to make sure that we are providing liquidity to that sector in a responsible way, in a sustainable way that doesn't stretch folks from a underwriting and affordability perspective, but helps them overcome some of the barriers that exist to home ownership in a way that makes it plausible for them to successfully be homeowners. So moving on, I think, to the next slide. Credit risk management, well, I think you guys are familiar with our business model and what role we play in the market, obviously from a liquidity provision perspective, and keeping money flowing for the mortgage market and new loans. And then moving to the next slide, you know, really credit risk management is who we are. It's what we do at Fannie Mae. It's core to our business. As you see there in kind of the call-out box at the bottom, almost 46% of the loans in our single-family guarantee book were included in a reference pool for credit risk transfer. And certainly as the largest credit risk manager in the mortgage industry, we take our job seriously. So what does that look like? So if we move to the next slide, just at a high level, you know, we're certainly excited to share with you today the continued evolution of our credit risk management approach. We're going to have experts from across the company, largely from my team, who are here to share with you how we think about who we do, who we do business with, what loans we end up buying, how we then manage performance, and then how we resolve issues. Our technology is certainly, and our digital transformation is certainly key to how we do that. As Laurel mentioned at the beginning, we have some on-demand videos to demo some of our tools like Desktop Underwriter and Collateral Underwriter, both of which are key to our risk management process. So I encourage you to take a spin through those demos at a break or at lunch, and see how those technologies really help us bring our risk appetite and our risk management to life. We're also focused on continuously improving our risk management capabilities. Really, continued innovation and emphasis on data is a priority for us and key to our approach. As you all well know, the landscape's changing and industries across the globe are becoming more digital, more data intensive, less paper intensive, but the mortgage industry lags in that evolution. And while it continues to be paper intensive, our objective is to help lead the digital evolution of the industry. And we're doing that by leveraging trusted source data to improve the mortgage experience for both borrowers and lenders. That trusted source data also helps us enhance our risk management capabilities, and it helps improve loan quality and consistency. And so these efforts over the last couple of years are really the building blocks that make us comfortable offering day one certainty. And as Celeste mentioned earlier, they have also been key to our ability to quickly support the market during COVID, quickly respond and make sure that we were there to support the originations side of the house and keep the mortgage market flowing, but also be ready to help folks who have been impacted by the COVID pandemic and the ripple effects of the health crisis that have led to an unemployment crisis that certainly have put a lot of people in jeopardy of not being able to make their housing payments. And so that focus that we've had on transforming to a digital process, on continuous improvement, on being agile, being nimble, really enabled our speedy response and our ability to be ready to both help struggling homeowners and maintain a functioning originations market as the COVID crisis hit. So ultimately, our goal is to put the customer first, to create a simpler ecosystem, and to do both of those things while supporting sustainable homeownership and serving as good stewards for the investors who share in our risk. So if we want to move to the next slide, you know, it's really our risk management approach is one that's dynamic and continues to be proactive and try to anticipate or make sure that we're responding to current events and managing the risk profile through different economic environments. And so certainly after the 2008 crisis, we made a number of enhancements across the life cycle of our management of mortgages to make sure that we were creating a higher quality book, right? So we augmented underwriting standards. We eliminated a lot of problem products from the suite after 2008, which has led to a higher quality book. We've really pushed loan quality control to the front of the process, which has given us a higher level of confidence in, you know, what we're buying is actually what we think we're buying, right? Because we've got an eye into manufacturing quality on the front end. Similarly, we've strengthened our counterparty requirements to provide, again, greater assurance that our counterparties, both on the lender side from a rep and warrant exposure perspective, but also on the mortgage insurance side from an MI coverage perspective, those stronger counterparty requirements help us have greater assurance that those counterparties are going to be there to stand behind their obligations to us based on our business model. We've also strengthened our oversight frameworks to make sure that we have a view into and confidence in our lenders and servicers' operational capabilities to make sure that they're up to the task of creating sound mortgages and managing them for us. And then, obviously, key to the current environment, we have a suite of LossNet tools that are already on the shelf and give us the ability to manage problem loans as they come through. We have made some tweaks since the COVID crisis started. I think Cindy will get into some of the servicing changes that we made, including leveraging a new payment deferral solution that had been in the works over the course of 2019, really to focus on shorter-term hardships. But we quickly enhanced that to really be what we expect to be kind of the primary takeout, hopefully, for the folks who have been in forbearance as a result of being impacted by COVID. And then finally, you know, the technology that we use to deploy our risk management principles has, you know, Desktop Underwriter has been in place for 25 years, but we've really augmented the suite of technology tools that we use to deploy our risk appetite and our risk management principles consistently and efficiently across the spectrum from both the selling and the servicing side. Moving to the next slide, you know, I think one good example of our dynamic risk management has really been our proactive management of the acquisition risk profile. So if we, maybe my computer's lagging, but if we want to jump to the next slide on DU model updates, thank you. You know, we've made a number of updates in the last couple of years. I'm going to focus on kind of notable actions in the last 18 months, really with DU 10.3, the 10.3 version of Desktop Underwriter. That was rolled out in December of 2018 and was focused on how we could reduce multiple risk layers when we were seeing those increase as a function of the heavy purchase market, but also as a function of you know, the changes to the DTI threshold that we were directed to implement back in July of 2017. So we introduced DU 10.3 in December with the focus on better management of risk layering. We, in July of 2019, we made some eligibility changes. Those were not risk-driven. We were comfortable kind of with the overall risk box, but what we were seeing was an over-representation of some of the higher risk corners of the risk box in our mix of business as compared to kind of our overall risk of business, mix of business across the spectrum. So those July 2019 eligibility changes were to kind of help us balance a couple of sometimes competing mandates, right? So focusing on UMBS performance, focusing on our mandated return targets, making sure that we were able to achieve our housing goal mandate. And then, you know, obviously some of those changes helped us better manage risk as well. And so we were really trying to balance across all of those things. And then in April, and really kind of a testament to our ability to move quickly, within 2 weeks of the crisis hitting and the us seeing kind of the revised economic forecast based on potential scenarios under COVID and how that might play out, we were able to really kind of kick the tires on DU, come back with a recommendation to tighten a little bit in in response to that more pessimistic economic forecast, and got that turned around from beginning to end in about a month from start to implementation. And so those April changes, again, were really in response to the onset of the crisis and some of the more pessimistic economic forecasts that were coming out, knowing that this is a fluid situation and it's tough to model, it's tough to understand how it's going to play out, but we thought it prudent to tighten a little bit in response to the crisis, and we've continued to monitor that in connection with kind of what our expectations were, what we thought the multiple paths could be, to make sure that we are staying on top of our risk box for acquisitions. So what's that done for us? I think if we move to the next slide, you'll see a good comparison of where we are kind of today versus where we were at crisis peak, and then giving you a baseline of kind of where things were pre-crisis as well. So you'll see that we certainly improved the risk position of the company significantly since the crisis peak. And really, I'll even kind of focus in again on the last 15 to 18 months. The results of the DU changes that I just went through starting back in December 2018, when comparing Q1 of 2019 to Q1 of 2020, we've seen four or more risk layers drop by 65% in those acquisitions, you know, comparing those two acquisition vintages. We've seen three risk layers drop by 17%. High DTIs, so debt-to-income ratios over 45%, we've seen those drop by 40% when comparing those acquisition timeframes. Low FICOs, so FICO scores under 680, those have been cut in half. And then high loan-to-value ratios, so LTVs over 80%, those have dropped by 30% when you compare acquisitions in the first quarter of this year to the first quarter of last year. So we've seen some good risk improvement, again, over the course of the past 12, 15 months, not to mention kind of the strong position that we're in since the crisis. And then, you know, obviously we've been responding here, it feels like daily, from a policy and risk management perspective to the COVID pandemic. Really, our policy and risk management actions in response to COVID have focused on three areas. So the first has been providing prudent flexibilities to make sure the originations market continues to function in the face of stay-at-home orders, social distancing guidelines. I think everyone here knows that the mortgage process, in addition to being paper intensive, has a number of kind of personal, or typically has had a number of personal interaction touch points throughout the process. And those were certainly interrupted as part of the COVID crisis. And so we wanted to make sure that we were providing prudent flexibilities to keep the market functioning. And obviously it has. I think we've seen some of the largest acquisition months in a long time over the past couple of months, given where rates are. And so we were focused on making sure that market could continue to function. The second area of focus was really on providing relief options to homeowners who are impacted by COVID-19 and who are struggling to make their mortgage payments. So Cindy Danko is going to go through these in a lot more detail, but you know, we've long had a forbearance program that served as the backbone of our short-term relief options here that, to a certain extent, has been mimicked by the CARES Act. And then, as I mentioned before, we had a suite of loss mitigation options on the shelf that are already embedded in servicers' processes, already embedded in our technology, including our servicing management default underwriter, SMDU, and really kind of put us in the position to be ready to catch those borrowers coming out of forbearance once their hardship has ended. And as I mentioned before, Cindy will go into some of the details on the payment deferral option that we rolled out and just went live here a couple of days ago on July 1st. And then finally, as part of the COVID response, we've been focused on protecting Fannie Mae from a risk perspective, again, in response to that more pessimistic economic outlook, but also just the wide cone of uncertainty around the ultimate impacts of the health pandemic on the economy, on employment, and on the mortgage market, and how that's going to play out, right? I think we're all witnessing kind of the spike in new cases, new hospitalizations, and how that's going to play out in various states around reopening or slowing things back down. So really kind of a dynamic situation, and we've been focused on making sure that we're protecting ourselves and protecting credit risk investors as a part of this exercise. All right, let me move on to, I think, my last slide before I hand it over to Cindy. I just wanted to touch on our commitment to supporting affordability and supporting access to mortgage credit for low and moderate income borrowers. We've got a duty, a kind of a statutory duty to serve the underserved, including providing responsible access to mortgage credit for low and moderate income borrowers. But we also, outside of, I think Celeste referenced this earlier, right, outside of our statutory responsibility, we as a company are fully supportive of, really looking for ways to expand sustainable home ownership to those who have not had access to it traditionally. Our flagship program to support responsible, affordable home ownership is Home Ready, and that's certainly part of the normal course of our business. It was introduced back in 2015, so it's been part of our core product offerings now for almost 5 years. And really, again, Home Ready is a way to support low and moderate income borrowers. It's underwritten through DU and, again, focused on sustainability. Home Ready really tries to make homeownership more affordable through lower payments and lower costs, reducing borrower costs rather than stretching and underwriting. I think probably most of you know, but Home Ready is assessed from a credit perspective in the same way that all of our standard products are, maintaining our prudent underwriting and credit eligibility standards. And it leverages DU, right? The power of DU and Desktop Underwriter provides a consistent view of underwriting to support the Home Ready product. And it also provides lenders with messaging to let them know that a particular borrower is eligible for Home Ready, making it easier for our lender partners to offer that product. We did change some of the Home Ready features, the income limits back in July 2019 as part of that effort to balance kind of the representative mix with securities performance and our commitment to supporting low-income and affordable borrowers. The results of those changes were to drop the income limits from previously a 100% area median income threshold down to an 80% area median income threshold, to really better align the Home Ready product with our housing goals and the definition of our housing goals targets. Generally speaking, the commitment to the affordable product, the commitment to our mission is not at odds with our commitment to risk management, and we're leveraging Home Ready to provide that access and affordability in a prudent way from an underwriting and credit eligibility perspective. All right. With that, I would like to hand it over to Cindy Danko. Cindy runs our single family policy team, and she is going to talk to you all a little bit about the loans that we buy and how our credit policy translates into our acquisition profile. And then I think she and I will stick around for some questions. Cindy?
Yep, great. Thank you, Malloy. I'm happy to be here with you all today. Appreciate certainly you taking the time out to join us. And so as Malloy said, I'll dive a little deeper into how we set our policy and what that means as we think about working with our customers to digest that policy and ensure that they're able to deliver those high-quality loans to Fannie Mae. And so for this session, we'll focus on our selling policy, which is really about that front-end origination and the loans that we acquire. In a session after lunch, we'll talk a little bit more about servicing policy. So in terms of setting our selling policy, our credit risk philosophy is really about, and Malloy mentioned this, providing sustainable home ownership. This comprehensive selling policy development lifecycle process we have allows us to continually adjust policy based on what we're seeing in the market and our own data and analysis. And this has never been more true than the last 4 months as we've been responding to the COVID national health pandemic. Throughout this policy lifecycle, we continually monitor loans for performance and quality of acquisitions, and we make those necessary adjustments. I think Malloy provided a great example of that when he went through some of the recent adjustments we made based on what we were seeing related to COVID and the economic forecast. And so being able to deploy a policy change through Desktop Underwriter really allows us to have a quick life cycle as we think about the identification, right, through the active monitoring to the ultimate deployment of that new policy. We often, as we're thinking about setting new policy or deploying new policy, engage many stakeholders, not just internally, but in the mortgage industry, as we think about working with our customers, the lenders and servicers, who manage those loans. Again, we interact with internal stakeholders to ensure that policies are fully vetted and run through the appropriate governance process. And then other industry stakeholders, as we think about mortgage insurance companies, FHFA, aligning policies. That was a big part of what we did with COVID, was ensuring that we were working to align policy with FHFA and Freddie Mac, ensuring that we made it easier for lenders to be able to rapidly respond to the changing conditions. Once we've set new policy, if we move on to the next slide, once we set new policy, it's really important that we communicate those in a transparent, consistent, and simple format so that our lenders can easily digest and implement them. And there's a number of ways we do that with that constant communication. One way, as you're seeing on this slide, is through one of our digital tools we have called Ask Poly. It's an artificial intelligence-powered search engine that provides answers to policy questions that our customers may have. And it's really sort of the Google engine behind our selling guide and our servicing guides. It allows us to put in those policy changes real time so lenders have quick access to them. We also communicate, if we go to the next slide, through our selling and servicing guides as well as through regular monthly announcements, lender letters, and release notes as we think about updating our technology tools to align with that policy. In addition to communicating with our sellers and servicers, Fannie Mae's investor-facing teams do provide targeted announcements and commentaries to investors to support transparency into those seller and servicing guides and new product enhancements. In addition to the guides and the monthly announcements and lender letters, certainly our tools like Desktop Underwriter are also a communication and articulation of the policy that we're deploying. It is the automation of that policy that really allows for that consistent, constant real-time update and deployment to our lenders and servicers. Okay, if we go to the next slide, we'll talk a little bit about how we do that deployment, the tools that we use, and the primary ones as we think about supporting quality underwriting include both Desktop Underwriter and Collateral Underwriter. I'll talk a little bit about and dig deeper into Desktop Underwriter, and my colleague Jake Williamson will touch on Collateral Underwriter in a session coming up. So Desktop Underwriter, many of you know, really automates Fannie Mae's underwriting guidelines and credit policies by performing that detailed analysis of credit and non-credit risk factors. It's available to all of our Fannie Mae sellers and other originators, and it allows us to make a risk recommendation for the loans entered into DU. And so as Malloy mentioned, as we think about setting our risk appetite, we're able to do that quickly through Desktop Underwriter and ensure that it's applied consistently to all loans that it evaluates. And we continually update and innovate through Desktop Underwriter to enhance and ensure high-quality loans. The other thing we're able to do is leverage Desktop Underwriter as a deployment mechanism for other innovations that we'll talk about, including the DU Validation Service and Day One Certainty. These tools, Desktop Underwriter and Collateral Underwriter, are the most widely used tools in the industry in terms of supporting automated underwriting and a comprehensive credit risk management. So if we move to the next slide, you can see here that DU is really at the center of those innovations we deliver to the market and widely used, as I mentioned, by the majority of our lenders. 1,900 lenders and agents with over 90% of loans delivered to Fannie Mae being evaluated through Desktop Underwriter in 2019. As I mentioned, it automates our underwriting guidelines and our risk appetite, improves efficiencies in the loan origination process for our lenders as we think about automating what was a manual process. And it provides the lenders with underwriting and eligibility recommendations. And the output of Desktop Underwriter are all of those messages and verifications the lender needs to fulfill in order to deliver that loan to Fannie Mae. Desktop Underwriter also connects with a number of other tools, as I mentioned, internal tools, as well as a wide vendor system that allows lenders to access it seamlessly through their loan origination systems. Okay, and if we go to the next slide. I wanted to make sure we touched on the comprehensive risk evaluation that I mentioned on Desktop Underwriter and those credit and non-credit risk factors. So as we think about loans that are entered into DU, there are a number of items and data points that DU assesses as we think about the overall recommendation, including those credit risk factors based on a borrower's credit profile. DU looks at things such as the overall credit history, delinquent accounts, revolving credit utilization, any past foreclosures, collections, bankruptcies, credit inquiries, and trended credit data. It also looks at those non-credit risk factors, so typical to a loan, as we think about how many months' reserves does a borrower have, what's the loan purpose, loan terms, the type of property, and other non-credit risk characteristics that, when combined, really create that overall recommendation for.
Fairly close to wrapping up this section, so thank you, Malloy.
Yeah, I was just, let me catch up to where she
I think
was.
I'm back. Oh, great, Cindy. Okay, the joys of virtual sessions, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, we can hear you now. Yeah.
Okay. Hopefully that will be the only snafu.
Yeah. We only lost you for just the last few, few seconds of your remarks. Yeah. Thanks.
Okay. Great. So I was just about to move on as I reviewed the comprehensive risk evaluation, right? The credit and non-credit risk profile. They're listed there on the slide. You can see really showing that DU evaluates a whole bunch of the data elements that come in on the loan application and credit report. And so if we move to the next slide,
just one moment. There you go.
Thank you. I thought it would bring home sort of our development process and how we set policy and monitor loans to give you a quick overview of what we've done in the last 3.5-4 months as we think about responding to the COVID pandemic. And so both on the selling and servicing side, we had a rapid development and deployment process where we were able to, since March 18th, issue 29 COVID-related lender letters and updates. And you can see them listed here. They're all also available on our public website. But this was really us monitoring the market, talking with our customers and servicers and understanding conditions to really be able to provide solutions. One, as Malloy mentioned, to keep the market moving as we think about low interest rates, folks wanting to borrowers wanting to refinance and purchase new homes, as well as, on the servicing side or the back side, you know, those borrowers impacted by COVID and the high unemployment rates and everything going on in the market. And so 29 lender letters with that comprehensive development process we had and the efficiencies through that established process, we were able to rapidly deploy those and respond quickly to the market. And so moving to the next slide, you can see I've listed here across these three areas, originations, right? So selling policy, appraisal or collateral policy, and forbearance, some of those policies we were able to respond to quickly, right? So as we think about originations, if just thinking back a few months ago to all of the stay-at-home and shelter-in-place orders that states had, we had heard clearly from lenders that they were having a hard time with a number of things, settlement agencies closing, borrowers not wanting to go to a closing and potentially risk exposure to COVID. We were able to update our power of attorney and remote online notarization policies. We were able to put out verbal verification of employment flexibilities so that if a lender could not get in touch with the borrower's employer because the store or office or shop had closed, and we're trying to figure out how to transition to remote, we were able to put flexibilities in place to ensure that they were able to still verify that that borrower was employed. And those are just a few examples of all the policies we've been able to rapidly deploy and ensure that we were assisting in the market. Okay, and if we go to the next slide, we talked a little bit about innovation through DU. Right, and how DU really took what was a manual underwriting process that required a lot of traditional verification through a ton of paperwork and took a long time. And we automated that process through DU and created just a few years ago the DU Validation Service, which gives us the capability to ingest data from income, bank statements, assets, and employment, and verify a borrower's income, assets, and employment available through that data. This provided a lot of flexibilities for lenders and consumers, certainly that better borrower's experience, more operational efficiencies, as well as, tighter risk management as we think of direct source data and really ensuring as we look at that data directly from a bank or employer that, in fact, the borrower has what they said they had on the loan application. We took that a step further and have been piloting for a number of years now, the single source validation, which really gives us the ability to look at 12 months worth of bank statement data and have a sense of the borrowers, not just their assets and what they have in their bank accounts, but also their income through direct deposits from their employer. That is still in pilot. We're still learning a lot from that data as we think about structuring it, that, getting it in and assessing it. Okay, let's go to the next slide. Part of that direct source data included our ability to provide day one certainty. And this is really the waiver of representations and warranties as we think about getting that direct source data and having confidence in the data we get and allowing the lenders to have that rep and warrant on the data and the income or asset calculation. Okay, and I'm going to stop there. I know I ran a few minutes over. I apologize for that, but I think we were going to take a few minutes for live questions.
Operator, if you could remind folks how to ask questions.
If you would like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw yourself from the question queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, that is star and one to join the question queue. We will pause a moment to allow questions to join. And once again, that is star and one to join the question queue. We will pause another moment. And it does appear there are no questions over the phone at this time.
Okay, great. Thank you. So we appreciate everyone as we're working through the day here. We will take a 5-minute break. So by my clock, that looks like we'll start back up around 10:46. If everyone could be back with us, we will then turn it over to Jake Williamson and go through our credit risk management strategy. Collateral risk management strategy. So, please join us back about 5 minutes. Looks like 10:47 now. So we'll see you in a few. Thanks. Okay, everyone. We'll hopefully had a chance to take a quick break, and welcome back. So at this point, I would like to turn the call over to Jake Williamson, who is our Vice President of Single Family Collateral Risk Management. Jake, over to you.
All right. Thanks, Laurel. And good morning, everyone. I'm happy to be joining you guys virtually for today's Rating Agency Day. Hope everyone's staying safe and healthy, and I'm sorry that we're not able to do this in person. We always walk away with great questions and great dialogue, so I know we're missing this engagement this year for sure on our side. But for the next 20 minutes or so, I wanted to walk through Fannie Mae's collateral risk management framework, spend a few minutes talking about the advantages of collateral underwriter, and similar to the Cindy session, walk through a few of the major changes that we've launched in response to the COVID-19 crisis and the challenges that pandemic has caused. So moving into our first slide, I wanted to first start with Fannie Mae's overall strategy for collateral risk. You probably recognize this slide from last year, from previous decks. But before we dive into each of these strategic priorities, I did want to back up and give a little bit of history. You know, during the foreclosure crisis, there was a critical need to really segment the servicing default and REO functions and really invest from a resource, technology, and people perspective in response to the volumes that were associated with the foreclosure crisis. You probably recall that our SDQ levels peaked over 1 million loans and our REO inventory peaked to a little over 170,000 properties. And while segmenting these functions was definitely needed based on the heavy amount of volumes, we really needed to bring together and enhance how we thought about the feedback loop between what we were seeing from a collateral risk perspective on the default and REO side and how this might inform our front-end collateral policy, how we thought about the valuation process with our lenders, and even property eligibility and property requirements in our guide. So early in 2019, we made the decision to centralize all of the collateral functions under the risk organization, under Malloy Evans, who you heard from earlier today. And then shortly thereafter, we basically formed this view of our collateral risk strategy and its core tenets. Our first priority there in the left pillar is front-end focus, and it's really all about how do we improve the collateral risk assessment in the originations process. With all the advances in data and technology, you know, how are we utilizing all this information to really assess the collateral and with a high degree of certainty understand the value and eligibility of that property? And our ultimate goal here is to really improve our risk assessment by making the unknown known, and basically doing our best to make this assessment more science rather than art. Our second priority, which is that middle pillar there, and you'll hear more about this process this afternoon when we discuss valuations, but it's all about how do we continue to drive process improvement, reduce our costs, create more certainty or assurance, and improve our speed in our own valuation process. So we designate or reconcile about 200,000 values every year, across various channels using our valuations team and products. And there are many decision points in that process. You know, what products do we choose? What technology do we leverage? Which appraiser do we select if we're going to utilize an appraiser? Which files do I spend time to review and reconcile, and how much time do I spend on those files? We're in a constant state of striving for optimization in that middle pillar by continuing to adjust these dials to achieve a better process. The great part about this space is that all the lessons that we're learning in our own valuation process can actually inform the front-end appraisal and collateral policy and in the lenders and appraiser shops as well. So a great example of this is the use of maybe non-traditional appraisal products, things like desktop appraisals or bifurcated appraisals where you separate the inspection portion of the appraisal from the appraisal analysis. Many of you are aware that we've been testing a process called Value Verify, where we separate the collection of data from the actual analysis of the appraisal. We've actually done that since 2016 within REO and short sales. And so it was a great learning environment for us to be able to take that data and those learnings and be comfortable with offering that type of product or that type of process on the front end. The third priority, and it really speaks to mostly servicing and REO functions, but it's all about how do we continue to get better at improving our decisioning around delinquent loans and REOs. After retention options are exhausted, how do we efficiently liquidate that property and achieve the best severity we can? And you'll hear a lot about that great work this afternoon when we get into the property disposition session. But if you look at this infographic down the left side of the page, you can see our supporting tactics, use more data, improve tools, and optimize decisions. I did want to give a little bit of an example of what we mean by some of these tactics. Take, for example, use more data. Sometimes it's not necessarily using more data, but it's using existing data differently. But there is a growing field in the mortgage space called GIS, or Geographic Information Systems, where geospatial data can be utilized to basically assign risk. In 2019, we had a great example of this where we had a problem we were looking to solve within our review process where we select and sample loans in Hawaii that are potentially in lava zones 1 and 2. These are highly active lava zones. We don't purchase properties in lava zones 1 and 2. It's against our guide. And the way that we've done this sampling and selection criteria historically was that we leveraged zip code association. And as you guys know, zip codes aren't drawn in the perfect way to line up with things like lava zone lines or flood risk lines. So by switching this logic up and using Hawaii shapefiles that's available through their portal, we were basically able to take that geospatial data, take the latitude and longitude of the subject property, and with assuredness be able to calculate how many of the loans are actually in lava zones 1 and 2, and this basically reduced our false positives in the review process by 83%. So these types of little wins within that first pillar really add up and help tighten the way we manage our collateral risk. And I think that's a good segue into our next slide, which focuses on the criticality of appraisal data standards and data standards around the appraisal process. So in 2011, and in partnership with FHFA and Freddie Mac, we collectively launched an appraisal data portal where lenders or vendors through their lender agreements can load their appraisals in this portal for immediate feedback on quality or risk issues associated with those appraisals. And although this work is manifested through our proprietary tool called Collateral Underwriter, or CU, this would not be possible without creating and investing in the Uniform Appraisal Data Set, or UAD, and defining those standards, and then working with the industry and the vendors to basically create this integrated standard and the data sharing solution. But at a high level, when lenders upload the appraisal into this process, it basically would either flag some data integrity checks or pass those data integrity checks within the portal itself. Then assuming the appraisal passes those edits, our collateral underwriter tool has a framework of quality and risk messages that the lenders can also tap into from an oversight perspective. And this is all done well before the loan is delivered to Fannie Mae. There are basically three types of risk or flags that are noted within CU. The first one is property eligibility and compliance. The second is overvaluation. And the third is appraisal quality. When these risk flags are tripped, CU provides very helpful messages on why those flags are tripped, and it provides details around what the issues are. We'll get into some of those examples on the subsequent slide. But before we do that, not only does the analytics and data of CU drive lender oversight in QC, but is also a critical tool for our own review process, and that's actually where it started, was an internal risk management tool. So within LQC, or Loan Quality Center, you'll hear about that department and its functions later, The reviewer, when he or she gets a file to review from evaluation's perspective, he or she starts that research with NCU and evaluates the messages and the data attributes that are observed within that tool. And then lastly, within that same department, there's a group that focuses on appraiser quality monitoring. And if their issues are severe enough, right, we see repeat offenders or appraisers who are making maybe sloppy appraisals or mistakes within the appraisal process, we issue letters of concern. And in some cases, in the more severe cases, we may tip that particular issue to the state board for further review and investigation. CU Analytics also helps us to track this type of appraiser quality monitoring, and it may adjust how we look at our oversight protocols, where if we have a multiple offender or appraiser who continues to make mistakes, we may oversample that particular product from that appraiser. So in conclusion, like having this data standard defined early in 2011 has really allowed us to mature our technology, our oversight, and our analytics to really hone the lens around identifying and managing the collateral risk. So if we move to the next slide, I'll spend just a couple more minutes on Collateral Underwriter and the benefits of that platform. Although CU's power is much more robust than what's displayed on this page here, these four pillars represent some really good high-level categories to think about when we try to highlight CU's capabilities. You know, first, let's start with the appraisal analysis. Like I said on the previous slide, there are three risk flags that CU identifies when it analyzes an appraisal. It looks for property eligibility and compliance issues, potential for overvaluation, and the quality of the appraisal. CU basically scores each of those flags, those categories, and then aggregates those three flags into a single CU risk score. And that risk score is 1 through 5, where 5 represents the highest risk. Property eligibility and compliance is based on edits around UAD standards and compliance with UCDP requirements. Some examples of these issues could be that the appraiser marked a negative housing trend in the appraisal, maybe stated it was in a declining market or an oversupplied market, but failed to provide comments explaining or providing the rationale for that distinction. Or the appraiser's state license is in a different state than the subject property, which would be a potential use PAP violation. Appraisal quality notes potential issues with appraiser's methodology and basically has 4 subcategories: data integrity, comp selection, adjustments, and then reconciliation. And actually, if you were a trainee working for an appraisal management company or a trainee working alongside an appraiser, these 4 categories, data integrity, comp selection, adjustments, and reconciliation, these would be the categories that you would learn to complete an appraisal. So it's actually CU is putting itself into the mind of an appraiser and how they create the appraisal product. And the way to think about that is, one, do I accurately capture the property characteristics? You know, we can look across different comps and different appraisals that have been done in the past to really understand, did the appraiser capture that data correctly? Did the appraiser select the most similar comps to the subject property? Did he or she adjust those comps based on the market and the likeness of those comps to the subject property? And finally, did they reconcile their comps and the adjustments correctly by adding the risk weight to each to derive, you know, basically a value? All of those components really help us have confidence in the next flag, which is the overvaluation flag. And basically, overvaluation notes potentially overstated or unsupported appraised values. And as we've stated on the previous slide, in all of these categories, CU highlights helpful messages for lenders to review that provide specific feedback on those areas of risk. Moving into that second column on the slide, and an important component of the appraisal quality flag is data integrity. Given CU now has over 40 million appraisals in its data set, given that we've seen a property usually on average up to 5 times on a subject as a subject property or a comp, and given the standards in UAD, we now have a ton of data to determine the plausibility of the data attributes in the appraisal. So we can check the reasonableness of that data, how consistent the appraiser has been on a particular property with their own past reported observations. So if they've used a comp multiple times, we can actually see that in the data, and how consistent are they at reporting similar property attributes. And then thirdly, how consistent the appraiser is on a subject property based on data provided by other appraisers on that same property. And so all of this data is processed by CU, And given CU's overvaluation risk flag is driven by the accuracy of the data collected and reported, data integrity can really be thought of as a foundation of appraisal quality and forms kind of all the other risk flags that are associated with the property. The next pillar there is that comparable selection. This is probably one of CU's, I say it's one of CU's coolest features if you've ever logged into it. The comps selected by the appraiser are actually analyzed by CU and rank ordered against a pool of potential comparables based on the property's physical characteristics, the location of those comps relative to the subject property, and the timeliness of those comps, when was the property sold. And so CU utilizes a statistically driven approach to not only rank order the comparables, but it also uses that same model to determine the appropriate adjustments for each comp and compares that to the adjustments that the appraiser made. Lastly, in that last column or pillar there, CU also displays some helpful market data, things like median sales price, price per square foot within that census block that the subject property is in. It also overlays the subject property history of past transactions and as well as the current transaction plotted against a market trend in that zip code. So you can understand, is that subject property behaving similarly to what we're observing in that particular zip code or that neighborhood? All these features really work together to help the reviewer or the user analyze the collateral risk of a property. And it's evident in our usage numbers. Over 1,000 of our lenders utilize CU each month, and based on their review patterns, we can actually see which properties they review and research. The lenders spend about 50% more time and resources on the higher risk appraisals, so it is informing the way that they do their QC. Some of our larger lenders have over 100 unique user IDs and have really embedded the use of CU into their oversight routines and QC frameworks. And although CU was built as a risk management tool, CU has produced some additional innovational capabilities, which brings me to the next slide. And even though appraisal waivers have existed maybe for the past 20 years, it wasn't until 2016 when we introduced Day One Certainty and kind of brought the robustness of CU to bear on the appraisal waiver program. This was formerly known as the Property Inspection Waiver. You'll also hear us talk about appraisal waivers, AWs, PIWs. All of these are kind of synonymous. But within this program, we can offer appraisal waivers on low-risk eligible loans using CU and the vast appraisal data that's housed within CU. And the basic process is that the lender will enter a property address, some information about the borrower, some information about the loan type, purchase, you know, whether it's a refinance, whether it's a cash out, as well as the lender's estimated value of the property. So in the case of a purchase transaction, the lender is more than likely using the price that's from the sales contract. In the case of a refinance or a cash out, they're using their estimated market value. And DU performs some basic eligibility checks, and then CU does the same thing associated with the property and determines any exclusions from there. If both of those checks pass, then an appraisal waiver could be offered. But from a CU perspective, and to provide a little bit more detail on the process, basically for our traditional appraisal waiver program, the subject property generally has a prior appraisal on file that has been risk scored by CU. So CU has evaluated that appraisal in the past. If that prior appraisal had an overvaluation issue or was flagged with property eligibility or compliance issues, an appraisal waiver will not be granted. It gets kicked out and a traditional appraisal would have to be supplied. Assuming the prior appraisal doesn't have these issues, CU will use the prior appraisal and walk it forward utilizing Fannie Mae's HPI and checks that estimation against the lender's submitted value. You know, if the value is reasonable, the loan could be eligible for a waiver. And just to provide a little bit more context, there are additional CU exclusion checks that do occur. For example, we have a pretty robust filtering process around disasters. So if we know between the prior appraisal and the current date, if a natural disaster occurred in the area and that property was likely impacted by that, we would not offer a waiver in those scenarios, and instead we would request a traditional appraisal just to confirm that that property didn't have any surviving damage and that if it did have damages, it was repaired appropriately to be qualified for delivery to Fannie Mae. But I think I'll just kind of add a couple more points here on these bullets. But despite growth, right, that we've seen in our appraisal waivers in late maybe 2019 and early 2020, you know, this is driven predominantly by the refinance boom and the low interest rates, as most refinances have a prior appraisal in our database. Loans with appraisals still represent a majority of our transactions. And in fact, in 2019, on a monthly basis, we were acquiring loans with appraisals at a higher clip rate in 2019 than we were in 2018, even though appraisal waiver rates were a bit higher. And look, part of our commitment to taking some of the complexity out of the mortgage process is by creating some of these efficiencies and delivering innovations such as appraisal waivers. And so as data and data collection techniques continue to advance, think about 3D imagery, aerial imagery, image recognition, GIS, as we talked about earlier, this will open the door to a ton of additional efficiencies in the process and really allow us to align appraisal product selection or align our risk management protocols to the spaces that we need to deploy and really invest from a risk management perspective. But to finish out the session on collateral, I thought I would end with a slide that kind of highlights our response to the COVID-19 pandemic and some of the flexibilities and policy adjustments we've had to make in order to keep the process moving, despite the challenges of social distancing and shelter-in-place protocols. You know, similar to what Cindy discussed earlier, we've had to produce quite a few lender letters to provide those policy flexibilities to the market and to our lenders. And although all these activities and adjustments have been important and they've been responsive to the market need, probably the most impactful of these changes was permitting desktop and exterior-only appraisals in certain situations. And that's why we included this grid on this page, because it's really helpful to understand where these appraisals are permitted. This approach was done in alignment with Freddie Mac and under the guidance of FHFA, so Freddie has a very similar grid to this. We wanted to be thoughtful in where we were offering these flexibilities, right? Basically helping to appease issues where maybe appraisals were becoming difficult due to social distancing. But we also did not want to make the appraisal process so frictionless where we invited maybe a private to public risk swap during a time of uncertainty. So at a high level, the way to think about these appraisal flexibilities is the desktop and exterior-only appraisals are able to be leveraged in a purchase transaction based on the occupancy and the LTV requirements that you see in the grid here. And then in the case of refinances, if Fannie Mae already owns the loan, then an exterior-only appraisal could be utilized. In all other cases, for example, in cash-out refinances, we require a traditional appraisal. And right now, these flexibilities are in effect. They started on March the 23rd, and they're in effect for loans that have started their application dates on or before July 31st. At the end of March, we did expand these flexibilities into new construction. You know, initially we excluded new construction because our thinking was that these assets are vacant and traditional appraisals could still be leveraged. However, when a few of the states, many of the states, began declaring real estate and appraising as non-essential, and appraisers started to receive citations for being out during quarantine, we knew that these flexibilities were needed for new construction as well. And because some of the data that the appraiser needs to complete these appraisal products may be obtained from the builder, we layered on some additional controls for the lender and builder to follow. For example, we highlighted the documentation and photo requirements needed for the appraiser to complete a desktop or exterior-only appraisal, things like plans, specs, the survey, the plot, all the various exterior and interior photos that are required. And we also introduced a builder certification document that has to be executed, basically attesting that the information is accurate from the builder, and that certification is stored with the loan file. In this same update on March 31st, we did provide some additional flexibilities for our home style renovation product, specifically in the draw process where maybe COVID-19 is preventing an inspector from reviewing and signing off on repairs. Similar to the builder certification in new construction, we introduced a completion of construction certification, detailing the photo and doc requirements to basically signify repairs have been completed, and that allowed the next draw in the process to proceed based on that sign-off. In April, we added some flexibilities around condos. We needed to increase the LTV for waiving project reviews for existing Fannie Mae loans who were looking to refinance, given some of the challenges around getting documents and updated documents from HOA and COA projects. Some of them were closed down during the pandemic, obviously, as well as we made it okay for lenders to leverage 2019 budget schedules for those projects if the COA, condo association, hasn't been able to meet due to COVID-19 quarantines to ratify their 2020 budgets. We also, in this same lender letter, announced a nice feature that was added to DU that basically flagged whether a loan was an existing Fannie Mae loan so that lenders could easily take advantage of the appraisal or condo flexibilities if they needed to know whether the loan was owned by Fannie Mae. Lastly, and in May, we added some clarity for lenders on recourse removal. If a loan entered forbearance on a home style renovation loan during the rehab process, and what those requirements look like as far as reperformance and what was needed before recourse could be removed by the lender. All in all, I think the team's response to the crisis has truly been great. We've had great partnership with Cindy's team. A lot of the work that we do, Cindy's team has to get into lender letters and easy to understand communication vehicle. So it's been a great partnership within the risk organization to get these out. And it's been great working with all the different groups, including Cap Markets, to basically validate when these things are changing, do we feel comfortable? Are we feeling good about the risk? And so a lot of these changes were implemented, obviously, to keep liquidity flowing, keep the mortgage process moving, but I think we did so in a very risk-conscientious way and making sure that risk was at the forefront of our minds as we were making these choices. With that, I believe that is our last slide, and we're set to move into the Q&A portion of the session.
Great. Thank you, Jake. That was a really great overview. And we'll go ahead and see if we've got any questions on this section of the presentation. So as a reminder, to ask questions, please press *1 on your keypad.
And our first question comes from Jack Kahn. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Jacob, and thanks, everybody, for putting this on. I have a question for you just about the valuations. I think the premise of this question holds, but feel free to disagree. I think the share of refinances has increased recently over the last couple of quarters, at least generally. I assume that applies to agency loans. I'm wondering what you guys think about the potential effects on CU or appraisal waiver values during this crisis, where I think overall home prices appear to continue to be increasing as supply remains low. But just thinking about, you know, this, when you talk about like walking values forward, kind of using an HPI approach in a time where let's say purchase transactions at least seem to be a declining share. Is that any concern about how valuations might be going through the appraisal waiver process versus, you know, just thinking about it on a lower inventory basis?
Yeah, Jack, that's a really good question. I really appreciate that. A couple of things that I would probably highlight, and I think I mentioned this when we walked through kind of what we've seen from a volume perspective, is at least in 2019, when we've looked at the monthly loan acquisitions that required a traditional appraisal, that's actually been happening at a higher clip rate than what we've historically seen when appraisal waivers were lower. So from a volume perspective, we're still getting a good dense amount of volume to keep the CU models and oversight working pretty well. That being said, we do have a lot of internal governance and thresholds that we look at to make sure we feel good about where the waiver rates are coming out. And we occasionally revisit the tightness if we need to evaluate that. And so I think those are kind of two controls that we look at that we think are working well. The other thing I would share is that, you know, this is kind of a moving target, right? Because a lot of this is dependent upon how lenders prioritize workflow, right? And in the case of appraisal waivers, we do know that loans that leverage appraisal waivers actually close faster. It's cheaper for the consumer, right? They don't have to pay an appraisal fee. And so these types of loans get kind of prioritized in the workflow a bit higher. And so when we saw the pandemic hit, those loans automatically sort of get prioritized because from a workflow perspective, they can be closed and they can be effectively managed. And then, you know, part of the reason we launched the appraisal flexibilities was there was a lot of loans that got stuck very briefly when the pandemic sort of prevented appraisers from getting out into the field. So it is a good question. We're continuing to monitor it, but we do have some controls that we're continuing to keep an eye on to make sure that CU's power stays really strong. The other thing is we also have competing models internally within Fannie Mae. So we have our own AVM that we use within our loss forecasting or loss allowance processes. That is a constant benchmark that we're looking at. And it actually has a new machine learning version that we've been testing over the last 6 months that we're actually comparing that to CU's model. And that's another sort of champion challenger that we're using to make sure we feel good about the accuracy of the data.
All right, thank you.
And once again, that is star and one to join the question queue. And we will pause a moment to allow questions to join. And our next question comes from Christine Yin. Please go ahead.
Hi, Jacob. I just want to ask, have you seen any impact to home prices or appraisal quality during this time of the crisis?
Yeah, great question, Christine. Thank you for that. We actually look at all three of the risk flags on a monthly basis and even sooner or more frequently than that. And what we've tended to see is within the traditional appraisals, and keep in mind desktop appraisals are actually done on the same form and can be scored by CU in the same way, we've actually seen very little movement in the distribution of those risk flags over this time period. So the overvaluation risk has remained pretty steady. The property eligibility compliance issues have actually decreased over time, and then appraisal quality has remained relatively flat. And so even during this time where we believe maybe uncertainty is a bigger piece of the puzzle here, we're continuing to see those risk flags stay pretty stable based on the incoming appraisals that are being loaded into the portal. And the good news is, you know, all of these appraisals are actually pre-delivery. So it is really a lead indicator of what we're seeing from a collateral appraisal quality perspective. And when we announced the appraisal flexibilities, right, and we said we want to do desktop and exterior-only appraisals, which are fairly new to the origination process, they're not new to the industry, we've done them in the default side for a while, we oversampled those flexibilities, and what we saw was really strong quality. We actually looked at about 3,000 of those flexibilities within the first month of the policy change, and that quality of those appraisal flexibilities were just as strong as the traditional appraisal based on the data that we're observing.
And anything in regards to prices, home price changes, or have you seen any movement or, you know, trends in that department?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a lot of readings out on that topic. I mean, what I would say from our perspective, and this is probably more for kind of the back end where we actually transact and actually sell property, we've actually seen prices stay pretty stable, if not go up, because of the limited supply. So we've seen really good performance in our REO shop. It's a very different housing stock, right? It's more affordable. So in the places where you have a lot of first-time home buyers or an affordable price range, the survival of that HPI trend continues to be strongest in those types of housing stocks. Obviously, on the front end, we have a much bigger sort of breadth, and we're continuing to see strong stability there within prices based on what we're seeing in the data.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, terrific. I think at this point we're going to move along to our next section. Thank you very much, Jake. And so at this point I'd like to welcome Caroline Patain, who is our Vice President of Single Family Credit Risk Counterparty, and Bill Cleary, Vice President of Single Family Loan Quality. So over to Caroline and Bill.
Thank you, Laurel. And Thank you very much for having me today to talk more about our risk management strategy for how it is that we're managing performance both at the lender, seller servicer level, as well as for our counterparties. So moving on to the next slide, we have, within Fannie Mae, we follow a governance structure that aligns with the three lines of defense. So where Bill and I sit within our risk management framework is on the first line of defense. So through our business units and the practices that we have in place, we engage directly with our sellers and servicers and are managing and monitoring all of the activities that we're observing at the counterparty as well as at the loan level. We also align very closely with our enterprise risk management team, which sits on the second line of defense. The ERM team has various disciplines that are focused on our multiple lines of business across Fannie Mae, and even more specifically within single family, we have engagement directly with enterprise risk management counterparts for counterparty risk as well as observations within our single family risk framework. Above the second line then falls our third line of defense, which is our internal audit team that observes all of the operational practices across Fannie Mae and manages our internal control framework. So all of the reporting on how it is that each of the lines of defense are operating ultimately falls within that third line. As we're managing through our risk framework, we are taking into consideration key performance indicators as well as key risk indicators. Through the partnership and observations of the second line of defense, they are managing how it is that the organization is operating within our risk appetite, and any observations that are made are reported up through and up to the board of directors. So we are, as an organization, managing our risk framework much as we would expect our counterparties who we do business with to operate the same way. So moving on to the next slide. From a counterparty risk management perspective, the partnership that exists between the first and second lines is a key in this area. So the counterparty risk management framework that is primarily owned on this slide by our enterprise risk management team is that they hold the responsibility, again, of monitoring the key performance and ratings of how it is that our counterparties are operating. So in addition to sellers and servicers, they're managing other lines of business. And with our sellers and servicers, they're taking into consideration a quantitative as well as a qualitative review of the results that are being observed. Through the counterparty ratings, that's how we are able to make a determination on many of our risk-based decisions for how it is that we're engaging with our counterparties. As necessary, we will use those ratings when we are contemplating who would be potentially at-risk counterparties that may require more frequent engagement and discussion around their liquidity position, liquidity strategy, among other topics, to ensure that we've got the appropriate oversight and proactive actions are taken. On a regular basis, we are continuing to monitor how our sellers and servicers are falling within our eligibility requirements for profitability, net worth, capital, and liquidity positions. Risk management strategies that we may apply proactively would be that we would potentially apply higher standards for how a counterparty is engaging from a financial perspective, which may be to guarantee their obligations, a reduction of their exposures where we would limit their delivery capabilities, post additional collateral to offset the risk, and ultimately, if and when necessary, we have the ability to act on our contractual right to suspend or terminate a seller or servicer's approval. So moving on to the next slide, a part of how it is that we ensure that we're engaging with strong business partners is that we do apply a rigorous approach to our onboarding protocols. So before entering into a contract with a new seller or servicer, each applicant is required to submit all financial statements, policies, and procedures. The standard application review and approval process is typically about 3 to 4 months before signing contracts. During this time, we are looking to ensure the company is established with a 24-month operating history, that they do meet our minimum financial standards for eligibility, and that they can evidence the appropriate staffing levels and documented procedures. We do continue to observe their financial eligibility on a quarterly basis as long as they remain an active seller or servicer. Later on, we'll talk more about how we maintain insight into their operational capabilities on a risk-based approach. On the next slide, we give a little bit more details about how it is that we engage with our on-site and off-site review protocols. During this time, we have postponed our on-site review practices. However, we are continuing to engage with evaluations that are consistent with our standard practices. We are primarily focusing on the organizational structure and governance of the companies that we're evaluating to ensure that the practices that they have in place are well documented and organized to demonstrate the fact that there is a proactive engagement strategy across the organization with the right staffing levels in each of the key business process areas that would ensure success as their volume begins to grow once they are successfully onboarded. When we're working with companies that are requesting servicing approval, it may be at the same time that they're requesting seller approval. Otherwise, they may come in for servicing only approval. We are looking specifically, again, at their organizational structure and governance. So for those that are sellers and servicers, it may be a common framework, but others that are servicing only entities, we are looking very much specifically at how it is that they operate within a risk management framework. For those key practices that we're looking for in the servicing area, it would be primarily related to general servicing, solution delivery, and timeline management, which is essentially their delinquent loan management activities. The goal of each of these reviews is to determine the quality and effectiveness of each of their processes and controls. On the next slide, this is a view of our rep and warrant framework. So as it is that we're engaged with a counterparty in a relationship, we rely on our rep and warrant framework to manage performance. Before acting on our right to enforce the framework with a responsible party, we evaluate the circumstances and the loan's history to render a decision to act on whatever the identified breach may be. Bill Cleary will talk more about how we are proactive in monitoring the loan quality through automation to inform and make strides to prevent loan quality issues. So moving on to the next slide. To maintain frequent communication and contact with our sellers and servicers, we have dedicated customer management solutions teams who offer proactive outbound communication on key performance and key risk indicators. The communication that they are providing to those sellers and servicers includes our observations of their loan quality, portfolio performance, and also just to keep them informed of all policy updates as Jake and Cindy had described. Each of the CMS teams are dedicated to particular clients, so that way it's understood who those key contacts are with each of our sellers and servicers, as well as having that relationship is the connection that's necessary for us to continue to make recommendations for where additional services and or technology support can lead and contribute to that seller or servicer's success. The information that is also communicated through these relationships is inbound, and it gives us better information for how it is that we can continue to fortify our processes and our services as well as policies to enable success in the market. On the next slide, this is an overview now of how we are continuing our risk management oversight for approved sellers and servicers. So as someone is actively working through the delivery and servicing of loans, we have ongoing monitoring and controls that include an operational review, which is called a mortgage origination risk assessment. And when necessary, we may apply targeted lender oversight. We're also performing ongoing loan data analysis and monitoring through the Data Validation Center and loan quality monitoring through the file level reviews. We will talk more about each of these risk management practices, and now I'd like to introduce Bill Cleary to explain more about our lender loan quality monitoring and controls.
Thanks, Caroline. One of the key components to how we manage performance and the quality of our book is through our loan quality control program. Every month, we perform a forensic loan level review of a sample of recently acquired loans. Now, this review entails a full re-underwriting of the credit file, recalculating income, assets, DTI, re-verification of employment. It includes a review of the appraisal, checking appraisal quality, validity of comps, and any adjustments used, and assessment of property condition, as well as a check for property eligibility. Additionally, our Data Validation Center, as Caroline mentioned, checks for data accuracy as well as running points and fees tests to check for compliance with anti-predatory lending laws. For newly acquired loans, we have a fairly robust sampling strategy that combines both random selections and targeted or discretionary selections. The statistically valid random sample that we perform on the aggregate book is really meant to give us an indication of overall loan manufacturing quality and identify any emerging quality issues. We have a strong feedback loop to both our credit and collateral policy teams to discuss the need for policy changes or clarifications that might bubble up from these loan level quality control reviews. One example of that is in the past, we've adjusted our guidelines for the use of rental income based on findings that we were seeing in our loan level QC. We also have a lender stratified random sample that provides a statistically valid defect rate for each of our top 20 or so lenders. This allows us to compare performance across lenders and drive specific lender level quality control improvements and action planning. And then in the vein of trust but verify, we have supplemental random selections to ensure that every lender that delivers at least 10 loans to us in a given year has files that are selected for review. Now, to complement our random quality control reviews, we also perform targeted or discretionary reviews that are driven by proprietary models that identify loans with a high likelihood of a defect. These models leverage data from a variety of sources, including desktop underwriter, collateral underwriter, delivery data, and third-party sources such as credit bureau information. Other types of targeted reviews might focus on new lenders or emerging risks. For example, in response to COVID-related policy changes, we have targeted samples to ensure compliance with the recently announced collateral and credit flexibility. Reviews of non-performing loans are primarily viewed as a mechanism to mitigate losses. So this is generally a recovery function. Loans are reviewed based on a repurchase risk score that assesses likelihood of loss and likelihood of significant defect. And obviously in recent years, non-performing loan reviews have been a lower portion of our overall review due to the low level of delinquencies. In looking to our next slide, I'll provide a focus on our defect types and the associated remedies, since I touched on our review process in my opening comments. We have three main types of defect classifications. Findings, which are minor errors that don't require a price change or make the loan ineligible for delivery to Fannie Mae. We have price-adjusted loans, or PALs. PALs are loans that are eligible for delivery to Fannie Mae, but when we reviewed them, we identified an error that necessitated a price change. Depending on the type of data change or the nature of the data change, this could trigger cash reference pool removal. So a good example here would be a loan is delivered as a site-built single-family loan, and during our review, we find that it's actually an MH loan. That would not only trigger a data change and a price adjustment, but would likely trigger cash reference pool removal. And then lastly, we have significant defects. These are defects that would generally render the loan ineligible for delivery to Fannie Mae. The standard remedy here is repurchase of the loan or a repurchase alternative. Repurchase alternatives may include an upfront fee or an agreement by the lender to repurchase the loan at a future date, should it go delinquent. Or it can be a combination of those two. And I would note that repurchase and repurchase alternatives are treated as cash reference pool removals. Now, as the next slide demonstrates, the quality of loan manufacturing as represented by the significant defect rate of our random post-purchase reviews has improved dramatically since the crisis and continues to remain relatively low, in part due to the many changes that we've enacted since the crisis. We've added extensive QC requirements for lenders in Section D of our selling guide, and we continue to update those requirements as needed. For example, last year we updated our requirements related to statistical sampling for lenders using those methods. And in stark contrast to pre-crisis days, the vast majority of loans we review are recently delivered performing loans. This allows lenders to remediate issues more readily and provides them with timely, actionable feedback that can be used to identify training opportunities for staff or quickly correct any systemic process issues. Now, despite all the progress we made, you know, we believe we can continue to improve and do better. Some of the more common defects we see are related to undisclosed liabilities or income calculation errors. And as we continue to evolve and improve our income and asset validation services over time, the big promise of our digital strategy should be to further mitigate these issues. As you can see from the next slide, as a company, we continue to invest in our QC processes. Just last year, we rolled out Loan Quality Connect, a real-time workflow management system that both Fannie Mae and its customers work in together to manage the QC process. A key feature of this new system provides our lenders feedback 15 days sooner on potential defects, really giving them a head start on remediating the issue even before an official defect notice is issued to them. But I think the next slide really highlights some of the most impactful changes that we've made to improve loan quality, really centering on ensuring our lenders are continually focused on loan quality, providing quality control training, and best practice sharing throughout the industry. We have a dedicated staff of roughly 15 quality control specialists that are assigned to our top 50 lenders. These quality control specialists monitor trends and performance, not only on Fannie Mae production, but also the lender's overall book of business. They review and provide input to the lender's overall QC plan, covering both pre- and post-funding quality control processes. And for our largest lenders, we conduct monthly quality control exchanges where we identify opportunities for improvement, assist with action planning, share good practices, and focus on training. To further supplement our guide requirements around quality control, we've also developed Beyond the Guide, which is essentially a how-to manual for developing and maintaining a robust quality control plan and risk management culture. Beyond the Guide covers a wide range of topics from data validation to doc review, pre-funding QC, post-funding QC, management, reporting, and action planning. Working with our lenders to promote risk management, provide training, and implement best practices is a critical component of how we manage and remediate risk here at Fannie Mae. And one of the ways we do that is through our annual risk management bootcamp. Now, in a typical year, this would be the point in the presentation where I have a dynamic video that shows you really what the bootcamp experience is like. Unfortunately, due to the pandemic, having our traditional bootcamp was not possible this year. So we've continued to focus on other methods of training we have available and staying closely connected with our customers to ensure good loan manufacturing quality as they manage through the challenges presented by the COVID-19 pandemic. And with that, I will turn it back over to Caroline.
Thanks, Bill. Okay, so now we're going to talk more about how it is that we're conducting our counterparty reviews from an operational perspective. With the mortgage origination risk assessment, we are assessing a lender's compliance with our selling guide requirements and their operational best practices. From a servicing perspective, we have the Servicing Total Achievement and Rewards Program, which is commonly known as STAR. This is where we're performing the operational review and compliance evaluation with the servicing guide requirements and observing operational risk as well. As we approach the review process, each program has inclusion criteria that is based on risk characteristics that would help us identify which of our sellers or servicers are presenting risk that would essentially cause us to engage more readily. Given the fact that we do have such a broad range of active sellers and servicers, we have about 1,200 active deliverers today, that we would have to limit our focus to those that are presenting risk characteristics at that given point in time. From a MORA perspective, we would generally review about 80 servicers on our general inclusion criteria, but may apply additional risk-based characteristics to pull in additional sellers for review. And on the servicing side, as seen within our publicly available STAR documentation, we have about 40 servicers that would be included on an annual basis. With that organization selection, we then engage with our customer management solutions teams as well as the sellers and servicers directly to schedule a review, issue a document request, receive that documentation, perform all of the documentation review on-site at a Fannie Mae location before going off-site and into a seller or servicers organization based on the timing of the review, where we would actually observe how it is that each of the organizations operate, meet with various executives across the organization, and provide any insight into our findings. When it comes to the way that we're operating today, all of the reviews are still taking place in the same format. However, we're just not going on site to any of the servicer or the seller locations. So all of the interviews are taking place through scheduled conference calls with the appropriate executives with the responsibilities within each business process area. At the completion of the assessment, we issue a final report that documents our observations throughout the course of the review. And if findings are identified, we will issue an action plan where servicers and sellers have 30 days to provide their response and document how it is that they will correct any of the issues that have been identified. The action plans are monitored within a independent team within our counterparty risk oversight group that are responsible for ensuring that each of the findings have been remediated to our satisfaction with validation in certain cases. Moving on to the next slide. We also use data analytics to help us assess the quality and management of our selling capabilities. So when we're looking at the sellers that are currently active in our portfolio, we're evaluating key risk characteristics and attributes through this tool that's called Leopard. It's for internal use only, and it's primarily used within our customer management solutions teams and how it is that they're bringing forward the observations on data performance and how it is that each of our sellers are performing relative to one another. With those conversations, it does help to target the right approach and improve performance as it is that we're managing the risk of the deliveries that are being received. This information is also leveraged in how it is that we're approaching an operational review as well within the MORA program. On the next slide, to talk more about the STAR program, this is where we have dedicated protocols for servicing activities. In this current environment, we are retaining much of what it is with the lessons learned during the loss mitigation activities that were observed in the 2008 and on timeframe, that through these practices, we've maintained engagement with our key selling partners that hold a large percentage of our portfolio. And the value of the STAR program is that it aligns our expectations with the servicer's performance for shared outcomes, so ensuring that our credit performance quality remains as effective. Through the observations that are made with the operational reviews, we're able to identify, again, if there's any deviation from our compliance expectations, but we can also make recommendations for how we can enhance operational practices by offering a perspective on how it is that we would recommend best practices in key process areas are implemented based on the observations of our largest servicers within our portfolio. For those that are high-performing servicers within the context of the STAR program, we do offer recognition that's called the STAR Performer Program. And servicers that are included for a review as well as a scorecard in general servicing or solution delivery or timeline management or all three categories may be eligible for recognition in one or all three, depending on how their performance was rated and their inclusion. Moving on to the next slide. The data analytics that we're using to evaluate performance within the STAR program is through the STAR Performance Scorecard. The scorecard is a public available document for the selected servicer. So it's not available to the industry, but it is a transparent way that between Fannie Mae and the particular servicer, they can review their results and how it is that their particular portfolio of loans is performing relative to a comparable pool of loans of Fannie Mae's portfolio. Within the scorecard, it gives a perspective in general servicing on how it is that the servicers are managing their investor reporting activity, in addition to early stage delinquency, which would be our transition to 60 activities, and then moving into solution delivery, we would be looking at loss mitigation results. So within this area is where we're looking at 60-plus delinquent loans, how those loans are performing, how effective the modifications are that are being offered, how effective the liquidity solutions are being offered, as well as observing through the operational reviews how they're performing their borrower outreach. So as it is that we're managing the performance in the solution delivery space, it would then limit who it is that actually has a high population of loans within the timeline management area. Timeline management is focused on REO events, bankruptcy, and timeline management for foreclosure-related actions. And then moving on to the next slide. There are incentives to drive increased performance on our servicing portfolio. So at a loan level, servicers are encouraged to perform more timely in their engagement on loss mitigation strategies. Applying the right strategy for the right customer is also beneficial for both the borrower as well as it is for the servicer. Incentives as high as $1,600 for eligible modifications occurring for loans that are less than or equal to 120 days delinquent are primarily what would ensure that that our servicers are actively engaging timely in mitigating the credit losses. When it comes to short sale and mortgage release activities as we move into later stages of delinquency, incentives are still available, again, to prevent moving into a foreclosure situation. So it helps to ensure that the servicers are recognized for the additional level of effort that's required in loss mitigation, but also that they are developing the right processes and protocols to engage borrowers timely, mitigate the exposure that the borrower has for loss, as well as the loss that would be experienced by both the servicer and Fannie Mae. And then moving on to the next slide. For remediation and escalation, so I touched on the fact that we have a dedicated team that's responsible for managing the action plans of any identified findings. If during the course of the remediation activity, we're finding that the servicers are not satisfactorily clearing the condition by not necessarily improving the process, or if they're unable to act timely in remediating the issue, we do have escalation protocols that are in place. So once we are aware that there is some type of compliance issue, that matter is managed effectively through ongoing engagement with the remediation team, monitored through reporting that would identify if someone is off track in the remediation, and as necessary would be escalated to senior leadership for observation and recommendations for how to address the deficiency. And then moving on to the next slide. There are remedies for non-performance. So if there were an occurrence that a servicer or even a seller through the MORA program has not completed their remediation, we would take the appropriate steps to evaluate the exposure that has now been created by that non-compliant activity. So when reviewing a potential risk, we are taking a look at the observed harm, defining what the remedies would be applicable for that particular scenario, monitoring the breach, selecting and pursuing the appropriate remedy, and then acting on that. So when thinking about what the remedies would be, is how it is that we're engaging at both the loan level as well as evaluating the counterparty in itself. So at the loan level, if we're seeing that there is a defect on loan quality, we are providing the opportunity to cure the issue, potentially offering a repurchase alternative or ultimately moving down the path of a repurchase. At the counterparty level, we're also assessing whether or not compensatory fees would be appropriate to apply to remedy the situation. And all of that would be clearly outlined within the Fannie Mae Selling and Servicing Guide for servicers' transparency of awareness of their obligations. And this is the full oversight program that we have for our risk management strategies, and I think we have a few minutes for any questions.
Yes, just as a reminder, star one to ask any questions. We'll just take a quick second to see if there's any questions for this section. Thank you, Caroline and Bill, that was very informative.
It does appear that there are no questions over the phone at this time.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. So thanks, everyone, for joining us this morning. We'll go ahead and now take a break until 12:30 for lunch. If you do have the opportunity, I would encourage you to please visit our microsite to look at the on-demand demo videos. So if you've been to one of our rating agency days before, you know that we usually do a nice demo breakout at lunchtime where you'll be able to see desktop underwriter, collateral underwriter, and HomePath Community First. Quick note, just again, housekeeping, if you are idle on the Deal Roadshow platform for more than 15 minutes, you will likely need to log back in with your email and the code FMAE2020. Also, if you choose to disconnect the audio line, please dial back in by around 12:15 to ensure the 12:30 start time for our afternoon sessions. So again, thanks, and enjoy your lunch, and we'll see you back at 12:30. Okay, everyone. Welcome back from lunch. We will go ahead and get started back up again. Apologies for the short lunch break, but as you see, we have had a lot of really meaty and insightful information to cover. And so, as you can tell, we're trying to put a lot of things into this somewhat shorter day than we would normally do for the entire business overview. So appreciate you sticking with us and coming back from lunch. At this point, I would like to welcome back Cindy Danko, who you heard from earlier. Cindy's joined on the line by Richard Plotnick, our Director of Single Family Digital Products, as well as Kathleen Pagliaro, our Director of Credit Risk Transfer. So with that, I will kick it over to Cindy, Richard, and Kathleen. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Laurel, and thanks, everyone, for joining us again. We're going to jump into slides to go through servicing policies. So if you remember earlier this morning, we talked about selling policy and how that was really set, developed, deployed to ensure that, lenders are originating high-quality loans to enable sustainable home ownership, and that Fannie Mae acquired those loans in the appropriate manner. And so I want to talk to you about servicing policy and how those two things link together. And so as we think about servicing policy, it's really a good opportunity just to stress how much we've learned over the years as we think about integrating that front end and back end credit risk management and why it all sort of makes sense, right? And a couple of those key learnings that I thought were important to point out, and this applies, on the selling side as well, as we think about creating and publishing simple programs and policy guidelines, right, that have flexible requirements. That always leads, of course, to better solution implementation and effectiveness as we think about servicers helping borrowers, especially those borrowers or homeowners who are in need of that help. One key component of that is early engagement, right, with a borrower or a homeowner. We've learned that early engagement with a struggling homeowner, that's really challenged with making his or her monthly mortgage payment, that early engagement results in a better outcome, not just for the homeowner, but for the community and the investor as well. And so we established through our policy guidelines a uniform standard called QPRC, Quality Right Party Contact, and that is a standard for communicating with a borrower, co-borrower, or even a trusted advisor to support the resolution of a mortgage delinquency. So should that homeowner get behind or struggle with making the mortgage payment? And it really outlines the guidelines for the servicer to make every attempt to achieve that standard and help that homeowner. Right, it helps to determine what's the reason for the delinquency, whether it's temporary or permanent, whether the borrower has the ability to pay the mortgage or if they just can't anymore, and then how to educate the borrower on the options available to them to help them stay in their home and continue to make a payment. And of course, obtaining a commitment from the borrower to do so. Those goals there really help to ensure that the servicer is working closely with the borrower. And of course, we establish and monitor that servicer's progress against the transparent outreach timelines to assist that borrower and prevent foreclosure. lots of benefits, as I mentioned, across the board as we think about QPRC and that early outreach to the borrower, and not just to Fannie Mae, but to the servicers and homeowners themselves. And if we go to the next slide, I thought it would be real important to show you those timelines and sort of when we talk about, you know, having that uniform standard, it's really a very prescriptive approach to what that looks like and at what day in the month or in that cycle that the servicer should really be reaching out to the borrower. And that is, again, in an effort to ensure that that servicer is doing everything they can to help that homeowner make a mortgage payment and stay in their home. One of the things that I wanted to talk about just before we go to the next slide is I mentioned when we talked about selling policy that in the last 4 months, as we thought about COVID and the impact to, you know, Americans across the country, on the servicing side, we really had to ensure that we were developing solutions, policies, and options for servicers to help homeowners who were impacted. And so those really came out in several lender letters we did for servicers and included lots of stuff related to forbearance and forbearance plan eligibility, evaluating borrowers for workout post-forbearance, as well as the introduction of the new COVID-19 payment deferral solution. Malloy mentioned that earlier. And so let me just dive a little bit into that and make sure that, you know, we talk about the payment deferral. And you know, it gives you a really good example of how we're working, assessing current market conditions, what's going on, and what might be best for helping servicers and borrowers. So if we think about forbearance, many of you know that that's a plan that allows for reduced or suspended mortgage payments for a designated period of time. In terms of COVID and a forbearance plan, right, for a borrower impacted by COVID-19, servicers must comply with the terms of the CARES Act, which requires that a forbearance plan be provided to a borrower who requests the plan with an attestation of a financial hardship that was caused by COVID-19. No additional documentation is required other than that attestation. The borrower must be provided an initial forbearance plan for up to a period of 6 months, and it can be extended for an additional 6 months at the request of the borrower. And then following forbearance, the borrower is not required to repay missed payments all at once, but they have the option to do so through reinstatement should they choose that route. If they do not take reinstatement, the borrower can set up a repayment plan to catch up gradually. And that repayment plan, if the borrower doesn't want to do a repayment plan, they have the option of what we call payment deferral, the COVID payment deferral. And we announced that in our lender letter 2020-07. It's a new, as I mentioned, home retention option. It was jointly developed and aligned with Freddie Mac at the direction of FHFA. And then this new COVID option, payment deferral option, is specifically designed to help borrowers impacted by COVID-19 return to their mortgage to a current status after up to those 12 months of missed payments through that forbearance. So that's available now as of July 1, 2020. And again, it's offered once that hardship has been resolved and the borrower is able to begin making those full monthly contractual payments again. And of course, if the borrower is not able to make that full monthly contractual payment, another option in the workout solution is what we call our flex mod. And so that would be an option that offered the borrower a reduced monthly payment based on their circumstances. And that was introduced, the flex mod, back in 2016 and is also aligned with Freddie Mac and at the direction of FHFA. So that was just an example. I gave a couple on the selling side, but that was an example of a couple things that we were able to quickly work through and implement as COVID hit and we were really understanding the market and impact to borrowers. Okay, so if we go to the next slide, one of the things that is really important also as we think about servicing policy is ensuring that we have comprehensive disaster and hardship response solutions. So through our policies and both the selling and servicing guidelines, we're able to offer disaster and hardship response solutions. So should a borrower be impacted by a natural disaster, we're able to quickly ensure that there's a solution that would help them get back on their feet. This includes things like homeowner support, customer support, loss mitigation solutions, property preservation, and neighborhood stabilization solutions. And these really are meant to provide assistance to servicers so they can work with their homeowners during that time of crisis. Now, much like on the front end, we have learned that, I mentioned a few slides ago, implementing simple solutions that we can publish through our servicing guide or lender letters or announcements in terms of how we communicate that to the market is very important, as well as automating and deploying those policies through technology solutions in order to enable that consistent real-time access to those new solutions. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Richard to talk through some of the automated loss mitigation systems that we have to support servicing policy.
Thanks, Cindy. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm just going to take a few minutes to talk to you about our automated loss mitigation decisioning system that we refer to as SMDU, or the Servicing Management Default Underwriter. It's been around for about 10 years that we created after the last crisis for the most part, and really provides servicers an ability to ask Fannie Mae in an automated fashion to decision the workouts. In a nutshell, it basically codifies Fannie Mae's policy for all loss mitigation activity. It provides the ability to quickly respond to market conditions. As Cindy just shared, the work we were doing on COVID-19 in the last few weeks, and as of July 1st, we released the COVID-19 payment deferral program, which also include what we refer to as a hierarchy. So as borrowers are in need of assistance because of being impacted by COVID, policy outlines the steps for servicers of what workouts are available to those borrowers. And in turn, what we've done is automate that process and put it into SMDU. SMDU streamlines the underwriting and the messaging. It takes a holistic view of the borrower and the borrower circumstance. So rather than just look at, am I available or am I able to be availed of one type of workout, it looks at the borrower's situation and responds and provides the servicer back a full complement of options based on the hierarchy. So, for example, you may be eligible for a repayment plan and you may be eligible for a payment deferral. If your hardship is permanent, as in you have a permanent curtailment of your income, then maybe a flex mod is more appropriate. We would provide that as an option as well. Additionally, it provides options for those borrowers, unfortunately, that cannot afford to retain their property and may have to go down a non-retention route, which would be more in line with a deed in lieu, a mortgage release, or a short sale. So it really provides the full complement of workouts available. Additionally, it provides for rapid delivery of our solutions. For servicers, they have an option. They can use what we call a B2B connection. So their technology can connect directly to our technology, and we have several servicers who availed themselves of that. We also have third-party technology providers that have connected to SMDU and leverage the engine on behalf of their servicers. Most recently, about in 2016, we also created a UI experience. So we've made SMDU available to 100% of our servicer community, either through the B2B or the UI. And the data is the same. So if a servicer comes in through the B2B, they could also look at that same borrower slash loan via the UI. It's up 24/7, and due to our ability to leverage Agile, we are very nimble within the process. We also add, going back to the hierarchy, as part of the COVID-19 hierarchy, when we implemented the payment deferral, we replaced what we call the extend mod and the cap extend mod. So we were able to implement that directly for servicers. But again, providing servicers the ability to just be able to focus on the borrower, and by hitting our SMDU decisioning engine, they're automatically getting those new policies. The last item we wanted to go through is just the standardized data set. So it leverages Fannie Mae provided data wherever possible. We use origination data or property valuations or the modification history. We ensure borrowers receive consistent evaluation from servicer to servicer. So, you know, we've all heard in the past that one servicer does it one way, another servicer may treat borrowers a different way. By leveraging SMDU, we're ensuring our servicers are all responding to borrowers consistently and providing the same messaging and applying the policy consistently. Data views and messaging that we return within the SMDU engine can be directly shared with the borrower as part of communications. So we feel that's a huge benefit to these servicers. They're not out there creating their own messaging. And lastly, as a benefit to servicers, by Fannie Mae making those decisions, they are getting any rep and warrant relief. What servicers are responsible for is the data that's provided to SMDU. But the decisioning and the workout that's been availed to that borrower is purely a Fannie Mae SMDU decision. Next page. So what we wanted to do next is just give you a view of what that looks like. So we have a snapshot on the next page, which just shows you what a screen looks like in SMDU, just so you can look at it. So you can see you have the loan information at the top. There's these series of red, green, and blue dots, and that's really demonstrating what workouts are available to this borrower. So in this example, the first one, which was a CMOD, would not be eligible, but a flex mod the borrower is approved for. And this is just an example of the UI, just to give you a look and feel for what SMDU can do and how it represents the data back to servicers. So with that, I will turn it back over to Cindy to go through some foreclosure management.
Thanks, Richard. So as you know, in the unfortunate event that a borrower is not able to sustain living in their home, servicers are held accountable to ensure that foreclosure proceedings are conducted appropriately. By participating in foreclosure initiation, timeline management reporting, and process management. And as mentioned previously, these metrics influence the servicer's star rating. And once a home moves into Fannie Mae's inventory, we have a very robust in-house team that manages the disposition strategy to mitigate those losses for Fannie Mae investors and taxpayers. And I believe that Jake will touch on some of that in a session just after this. It's really you know, critical to understand that key role that servicers play as we think about ensuring that those foreclosure proceedings are conducted appropriately. Okay, and with that, I'll turn it over to Kathleen.
Great, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks to all of you for being with us today. I'm going to spend some time here walking through the application of COVID-related policies on cash flows. So hopefully you've seen the FAQs that we've posted online that also covers this information quite thoroughly. And if not, I would encourage you to check it out on our website. So let's begin here with temporary payment forbearance. Interest payments to CAS investors are not dependent upon interest collections on the reference obligations. Therefore, reduced interest collections due to temporary forbearance do not impact these payments. However, principal is not distributed to CAS notes unless it is collected from the borrower. As such, scheduled principal collections may be reduced as a result of temporary payment forbearance. This will affect the amount of scheduled principal distributed to CAS investors. Unlike MBS, there is no guarantee of principal for CRT investors, so scheduled principal is not advanced. It's also important to note that even if a borrower enters into temporary payment forbearance, he or she may continue to make scheduled payments and thus remain current on their loan. If a loan is in an active temporary payment forbearance, it will be reported as delinquent in cash and will roll deeper into delinquency by the number of payments not made. Because of this, these loans may be included in the distressed principal balance and cause the delinquency test that is present in the actual loss deals to trip, leading to the subordinate bonds being locked out of receiving unscheduled principal. Scheduled principal, however, is still passed through to the bonds as it is not locked out. I'd also just point out that for all of the CAS REMIC transactions, and those are the ones designated with an R prefix, the effect of the delinquency test can be mitigated via the allocation of the supplemental subordinate reduction amount, or the SSRA. In the REMIC deals, the percentage of offered notes and their corresponding reference tranches is capped at generally 5.25% or 5.5% of the current UPB of the reference pool. If this threshold is reached, the CAS notes will receive unscheduled principal, even if the delinquency test had been breached. Now let's talk a bit about repayment plans on the next slide. If a borrower enters into a repayment plan following temporary payment forbearance, the loan will be reported as delinquent until the repayment plan is complete. As the borrower gradually makes up the missed payments during the plan term, the loan will be reported as progressively less delinquent until the plan is complete, at which time the loan will be reported as current. For the fixed severity deals that include the casualty event reversal language, which are the later four fixed severity deals you see listed here on the screen, a reversal would occur if the borrower completed their repayment plan within the three-month window after the conclusion of the forbearance period. Now, we can flip the slides. We'll talk about the COVID-19 payment deferral option. There's a lot of information on this page. If a borrower elects the COVID-19 payment deferral option, the related loan is not treated as a loan modification for CAS. Under this option, the deferral of the missed P&I payments doesn't affect the ongoing contractual monthly payment due from the borrower and will not result in a modification loss amount to investors. Further, interest payments to bondholders will continue to be made and will be based on the total loan balance, which is inclusive of all deferred amounts. Borrowers that enter into a payment deferral agreement will resume making their contractual payments. However, the deferred amounts are not due until the loan's maturity or earlier payoff. Upon entering the payment deferral agreement, the loan will become current. For the actual loss deals, this means that a loan entering a payment deferral agreement will not be included in the distressed principal balance for purposes of the delinquency test. For all of the fixed severity deals, because the loan becomes current when the borrower enters into the payment deferral agreement, a loan that is less than 6 months delinquent prior to entering the deferral agreement will not become a credit event. For the later fixed severity deals, the ones that contain the casualty event provision, if the loan became a credit event while in forbearance due to COVID-19 and the borrower entered into a payment deferral at the conclusion of his or her forbearance period, that loan will become a reverse credit event obligation. And then finally, if a loan and payment deferral subsequently defaults, the severity will be calculated to include any deferred amount that is due as part of the payment deferral agreement, which would include the interest, taxes, and insurance in addition to the principal. This treatment is consistent with loans that default and are disposed of through REO dispositions in which such costs are part of the loss calculation. And then finally, let's talk a bit about loan modifications on the next slide. As Richard mentioned a few moments ago, for the COVID-19 impacted borrowers, the COVID-19 hierarchy removed the extend mod and cap and extend mod and replaced those options with the COVID-19 payment deferral and the Fannie Mae Flex mod, which is what we'll cover now. So in cases of permanent hardship where a loan modification is pursued, the implication for CAS investors vary by both modification type and across deals. If the borrower's hardship is permanent and he or she is unable to sustain their contractual monthly P&I amount they may be evaluated for the Fannie Mae Flex Mod, which uses several levers to reduce the monthly payment and may result in a modification loss amount to investors in the actual loss deals. As you're aware, there are no modification loss amounts passed through in the fixed severity deals. Although interest payments to bondholders are not dependent on interest collections on the reference obligations in the deals, certain modifications, such as a permanent interest rate reduction, permanent principal forbearance, may result in reduction of interest on the bonds. Modifications that result in term extension or capitalization do not result in modest amounts. When a modification is finalized, the borrower returns to current status and resumes making contractual P&I payments. If the amount of these payments is reduced due to permanent hardship, the amount of scheduled principal collected by the trust and distributed to bondholders may be lower. Modded loans are not included in this distressed principal balance unless the borrower has become 90 days or more delinquent after the loan had been modified. And finally, a modification is not a credit event. That wraps up what we wanted to cover with you today as it relates to implications for CAS. Thanks very much for your time, and Laurel, I'll turn it back to you.
Great. Thank you, Cindy, Richard, and Kathleen. I think that was, as I mentioned earlier, it's very insightful to see how much of our COVID-19 response really draws on especially within the servicing policy area, all of the things that we did to really shore up the book after the financial crisis, and that we were able to draw on a lot of the great work, especially with moving forward technology and SMDU and really our whole digital journey that we've been talking about for the past number of years for those participants that have been coming to our rating agency day for a while. So thank you for pulling all that together. With that, I'd like to just open up and see if we have any questions from our audience. So if we can just, as a reminder, please press star one on your keypad and we will take questions.
And our first question comes from Michael Shepard. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having this session. This is really helpful. I had a question just on SMDU. What is the take-up rate among the servicer population for that technology? Thanks.
Sure. SMDU covers almost 100% of the delinquent volume, meaning that the servicers that are subscribing to the service and the decisioning covers most of the delinquencies. I think historically, prior to COVID, the take-up this year was about 80% of all workout decisions, or executed workouts, I should say. But I think with COVID-19, we're seeing definitely an increase in that take-up rate.
Thank you.
Sure.
And once again, that is star and one to join the question queue. We will pause another moment. Our next question comes from John Shuck. Please go ahead.
Hi, I second what the previous caller said. I appreciate you guys doing this and it's being presented well. Question on how would we differentiate on reporting the difference between a forbearance and a payment deferral? A permanent principal forbearance and a deferral.
And when you talk about reporting, is that you're talking about within the CAS data?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't know, Kathleen, do you want to take that one? We also have some resources in our Q&A that touch on that,
I'm sorry? I was just
mentioning that we also, the Q&A that you referenced at the beginning of the call has some resources about how to look at the reporting, but do you want to?
Yeah, so you will see, so there is a forbearance flag, that payment forbearance flag that will be checked off, and there's also a modification flag. So disclosures, you know, we're working on enhancing our disclosures for a later release, that you might be able to see some differentiation between the borrower assisted plans, so that you'll know, you know, if a loan has come out of payment forbearance into a workout option. I think we've got those out in MBS already, so that's something that we're working on. But there is a forbearance flag. You will see it even if the loan is current. You'll see forbearance, and you'll see that the loan is current. But those are kind of the differentiators right now, and we're working on enhancements to disclosures that should come out in the near term.
And okay, Kathleen, I think you already mentioned this as well, but a payment deferral would not have a modification flag on it.
That's right.
Because that would not be a permanent modification of the loan.
Yeah, but that's considered more of that a borrower-assisted plan or workout, not a modification. If a loan is modified, you would see the modification yes flag.
Got it. Thank you.
And it does appear that there are no further questions over the phone at this time.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. So now, you know, we're closing in on the finish line here. So for our final session, I'd like to welcome back Jake Williamson. And Jake is joined by John Thibodeau, who is our Director of REO Disposition. So over to Jake and John. Thank you.
Thanks, Laurel. And if we could advance the slide one more, good to talk with you folks again this afternoon. We're going to spend maybe the next half hour or so on the back end liquidation platform and kind of give you an overview of some of our capabilities. Obviously, you heard from Cindy and Kathleen and Richard about the retention options and what we do there to keep borrowers in their homes where they're able to. But when those efforts have been exhausted, we obviously leverage our liquidation platform to dispose of that property as efficiently as we can, maximizing our proceeds, helping support neighborhoods, and minimizing our holding cost associated with that. So this first slide gives you kind of an overview of some functional capabilities. You'll see valuation, sales, and fulfillment down the left side. Obviously, we talked a little bit about valuations this morning and the support that they provide to the different channels of liquidation within Fannie Mae. So we reconcile and review about 200,000 values a year as support for these different channels of liquidation. Within sales, that really is about the marketing of the property, what rehab decision we want to make, if we're going to repair and make investments in that property, if we're going to sell it as is, if it's in good condition, we feel like it can be sold as is, we'll do that. What should the list price be? How should we negotiate offers? All of those activities are really where our sales teams excel. And then last, within the fulfillment space, there are a lot of operational activities that it takes to perform these different real estate services. These are things like mowing the yards, performing additional property preservation activities like winterization, snow removal. We talked about a repairs process. Clearing title issues, paying HOA and tax liabilities. When a property comes into REO and it's occupied, how do we handle the engagement with that occupant? Can we provide relocation assistance? Do they have a lease in place, and do we need to honor that lease? And so there's a lot of activities that are in fulfillment that help support that. And last but not least, I would just kind of do a quick call out on our vendor management capabilities. You know, we do business with about 2,000 different vendors to support this real estate process, and we need to have a very strong and robust vendor management process to make sure we're getting the performance we expect from our vendors and that we're able to deliver strong scorecards and proactive monitoring of that performance to get best execution out of those vendors. A couple of other bullets that I would highlight on this page, you know, we've disposed over 1.8 million properties since kind of the start of the crisis, 2008-2009. We use a real estate agent network to sell a predominant majority of our properties in post-foreclosure status, and there's about 900 agents that we leverage nationwide. You know, if you've seen this deck or this presentation before, that number has continued to come down. I think at the peak of the crisis, we had about 6,000 real estates we were partnering with. So as our inventory has shrunk over time, we've proactively managed that network down to around 900 folks that we use today. And then John's team is geographically based. They get very strong expertise working in specific geographies and understand those market dynamics and the different processes like code compliance, property registration, different activities that are specific to those locales to get really tight on how we manage the properties. And then, you know, we're no stranger to technology. You heard us talk about Collateral Underwriter earlier today and Desktop Underwriter as well. On the back end, we list our properties through a platform called homepath.com. John will talk a little bit more about that technology here shortly. But we've had more than 69 million unique visitors since inception. So, again, our goal here is to, you know, bring about the best execution we can, support communities and neighborhoods with a strong repair strategy, and try to shrink our carry cost or holding cost to get best X. So let's jump to the next slide. So this provides a little bit of perspective on our severity experience over the crisis. Obviously, you know, this experience from a severity perspective is when all the things are reconciled and all the receipts and expenses are accounted for. So this has definitely a lagged effect from when you see loan delinquency spiking. But when you look at this curve and what you see in front of you is our severity experience, and you can see that we've been able to bring down severity basically to pre-crisis levels and well below that. When we look at industry data, whether that's the public loss data or when we look at MLS data and performance of sales execution data, we tend to be placed among the strongest as part of like a distressed seller comparison. And just a stat that we really pay attention to, obviously with severity, we have a control over a majority of that outcome. But in certain situations, we obviously don't control how many of our properties come into REO occupied, how long it takes to foreclose, when there might be moratoriums, things of that nature. And so we really pay close attention to an execution number. It's also a lead indicator of where we think severity might land. And over this time horizon, we've executed at about 98% sales proceeds to value. And that value denominator includes any investment that we make in repairs. And so when you look at all the different channels and all the different disposition paths, to be at 98% is a pretty strong performance number. Let's go to the next slide, please. But before the asset comes into REO and after sort of the retention options are exhausted, we do try to liquidate the property soon, right? Because we can avoid a ton of cost by doing that if we can execute strong. And so two options that I'll talk about here, one is around short sales. You also may hear this referred to as pre-foreclosure sales. But short sales basically is a process where we take less than total debt to transact earlier and avoid the foreclosure. You know, historically, we have provided, based on our models and our analytics, we have provided a what we call a minimum net reserve number to servicers and basically issued guidance that if you're able to execute on that loss neutral strike price, then you can execute all day long. And what we tended to see over that experience was that that's what servicers did, right? There was no sort of maximization of execution. It was achieve the minimum net reserve and move on. And it wasn't the servicer's fault. It's just that's the way the process was set up, and that was a delegated function. So in 2014, after doing a bunch of tests and learns, we decided to bring that negotiation process in-house. We wanted to really focus on fair market value. Home prices started to come back. At that point, we really wanted to make sure that we were leaning into the market and negotiating the fair market value to bring severity down even further. And so in that diagram there in the bottom left, you can see Fannie Mae kind of inserting itself in between the agent, who may be the homeowner's agent or the buyer's agent, and the servicer, and helping to connect those conversations and that dialogue and that engagement so that we can perform a really strong executable deal, but also clear up any roadblocks that may be happening around documentation, or anything that may be stuck in the process. Now, obviously, the servicer still maintains all of the communication with the borrower. We don't step in front of that, but we do negotiate directly with the real estate agents that are involved in this process. And the great thing is they can come to us at any point in the process. So if they're just starting out and they don't know what to list the property for, or they have struggle around even just the homeowner finding a real estate agent, we can help with those types of activities given our experience within REOs. So we took a good portion of our asset managers that were REO experts and we moved them into this short sell space to really try to promote the great best ex that we stood up in REO. And by managing this process in-house, I mean, literally overnight, we saw severity within the short sell process decrease pretty substantially. And the great part was that we did not see a drop-off in volume. And so it wasn't like we sacrificed volume to achieve higher execution. We saw about the same volume, but at a better execution. And so we continue this process today. We use HomePath for short sales as our technology platform where the agent can log in and submit offers. And that's where we also process our workflow, so it's very transparent and visible to both the agent and the servicer. So really good process around the short sale space. If a short sale is not an option for the homeowner or they just want to get out gracefully and not deal with the real estate asset anymore, we have an option on mortgage release, right? And really it's kind of a suite of options, I'll say. But this is also known in the industry as a deed in lieu of foreclosure. This is a way for the borrower to basically hand over the keys and the deed to the house, exit gracefully, maybe receive some relocation assistance, and we and the servicer avoid the costly nature of a foreclosure, and we get the property in broom swept condition without damages to it, which allows the REO process to pick up and be efficient when we have the asset in our ownership. Basically, the borrower deeds the collateral back to Fannie Mae, and they get a release of repayment obligations under the mortgage. We don't pursue deficiency waivers. That's the benefit of the consumer working with us. But underneath this mortgage release suite, they have three options that they can choose from. They can just do what's called a traditional deed in lieu, where they deed the property over and they vacate the property immediately. They can do what's called a three-month transition option, where they can live in the property for up to 90 days rent-free while the property transitions to us if they need more time to move. And then lastly, if they need a longer arrangement, so maybe their kid has, I don't know, 6 more months of school left and they need to stay in that location, we can pursue a lease agreement with the homeowner. The two things we check for there is the homeowner's financial viability to be able to perform on that lease. But also we do an inspection to make sure that the property is safe and habitable, because our position really changes from an investor to a landlord at that point, and we're liable for property maintenance. So we want to make sure the consumer or the homeowner is living in a safe and habitable home. What we see with mortgage release in total is that it does contribute to a pretty significant net present value savings over a normal foreclosure and a normal REO process, and so we continue to provide this as options to homeowners. Let's go to the next slide, please. I believe the next three are focused on our valuation process. I'll wrap this up pretty quickly and then I'll hand it over to John to walk through REO. But really, and we talked a little bit about this morning, we're constantly tweaking the dials of how we value assets, which products do we use, what technology do we use, which loans do we review, which ones do we not review. And we believe that we've got some key platform advantages. We talked about collateral underwriter this morning, but the team also has access to a ton of MLS data. We have our own internal AVM that has been evolving over time. We have competitor AVMs that we purchased to really understand value. And quite frankly, we have just a wealth of our own data. So we've done about 3 million different valuations since 2008, and that has provided a very robust data set for us to really understand the trends associated with reconciling those values. We have a very tenured, very experienced staff within the valuation space. Most of them are all certified appraisers and have had experiences within the field working for appraisal management companies or as an appraiser and an individual contractor. And then we have about 22 field reps that are in key markets located across the country. Their job is to perform training with appraiser panel members or with AMCs or appraisal management companies. They meet with servicers. They meet with real estate agents. They may inspect properties if we're having an issue with a particular asset that we need to really get hands-on experience with. And then all of this is supported by a really strong vendor performance management setup. So we use both appraiser panel members as well as appraisal management companies, and we have vendor scorecards that oversee the performance of those entities, and that helps to feed how we assign BPOs and appraisals going forward. Whoever is the best performer and who has the capacity to take that work on, they tend to get the pick of the litter, if you will, on volume assignments because of their performance and their capabilities. So let's jump to the next slide. The only thing to maybe add to those platform advantages, we talked a little bit about the staff, the data and the tools, the vendor performance, but the way to think about how this works in practical terms is across all these different channels, whether it's NPL, RPL sales, REO, short sale, MI terminations, we're ordering some type of product. And over time, we've figured out kind of which products work well or which products are we legally allowed to do. So, for example, when we're preparing for a foreclosure sale, we don't own that asset yet. We cannot set foot on the interior of that property yet prior to foreclosure. And so we use exterior BPOs to help us understand and triangulate value using that product. So we've figured out kind of what these products are. We've set them up by channel. Those products come in. It could be one or multiple depending on the channel. And we have a lot of modeling and analytics that's provided by our single family analytics team that allows us basically to perform a risk-based triage of those products. And we spend a majority of our manual time, reconciliation time, focusing on those high-risk loans or high-risk properties, I should say. And so whenever there's noise in the data, whenever the products don't align with what we see from a market data perspective, or whenever we think there's significant discrepancy, we're definitely going to have eyes on that property. We may order additional products to help support our review. At the end of the day, a market value is determined. There's three pieces of that. We produce an as-is value, an as-repaired value, and the cost of repairs that we believe that it will take to produce that as-repaired value. And what this is a cycle. And so as we get experience with these transactions over and over again, and we manage not only our external vendors through scorecarding and performance management, but we also do that with our internal reviewers. So we have employee scorecards where we're refining and training and improving our performance on how we reconcile these values. So this sort of all works together to kind of create that best-in-class valuations platform. So if you flip to the next slide, I wanted to just highlight kind of what do volumes look like by channel and kind of where our experiences from a review percentage kind of stand. On the NPL RPL loan sale side, obviously these volumes are dictated by our calendar and by delinquency levels and different things that affect that that cadence. But from a valuation perspective, we may do about 15,000 values every other month. And we do utilize exterior BPOs because, again, these are active loans. We don't own them. We don't own the properties yet. And then we do about a 20% sampling review based on that sophisticated triage review I mentioned on the prior page. Short sale space, you can see the volume there. We order two products within the short sale space, typically an appraisal and a BPO, and we typically look at all of these. The short sale space, at least during the foreclosure crisis, had a propensity for potential fraud during the foreclosure crisis, pocket listings, things of that nature. So we really wanted to make sure we had eyes on the short sale channel. So we review all of those manually. For foreclosure auction or foreclosure bidding, also known as third-party sale, when that transacts, we do drive-by or exterior BPOs as well, and we review about two-thirds of those. On the mortgage release side of the house, this is really about performing an inspection and making sure that we don't have any property damage, right, because that would violate the mortgage release agreement that the consumer agreed to. So we don't typically review these, but they're done to make sure there isn't any major property issues that we should be aware of coming into REO. On the MI termination side and the modification side, these are really servicing activities. We perform valuation activities to support those two processes. And you can see the volume there is around 5,000 every month, so pretty significant channel for us. On the REO side, it's about 1,500 a month. And then we also support the front end. That's the advantage that I talked about this morning about bringing all these groups together. We can do appraisal modernization reviews on some of the newer products. We can look at the COVID-19 flexibilities and make sure we feel comfortable with those. So we're using those valuation resources to make sure we have a good pulse on that. So that's it for the valuations piece. And what I wanted to kind of transition to John is this is all about sort of drawing the line in the sand. And then John's team really tries to excel above that line in the sand, and they do a great job with their processes to do that. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to John to cover the next series of slides.
All right. Thanks, Jake. Well, my name is John Thibodeau, and I manage Fannie Mae's Single Family REO Disposition Group, which is a bit of a mouthful. Here internally, what we refer to ourselves as is the Single Family Real Estate Group. Because REO disposition ultimately is the goal, but really it's more than just that for us. We're really, at the end of the day, you know, we're looking to be a good neighbor, to be a good steward of the properties that we have in our inventory, where ultimately we're looking to do anything and everything we can to enhance the marketability of our properties, while, like Jake mentioned earlier, you know, supporting neighborhood stabilization. And this can't be accomplished without really an army of folks, both internally as well as within our own vendor group, where on the maintenance and field QC side of the house, you know, we have both regional and national suppliers that support maintenance activities. Jake talked about this a little bit, but, you know, everything from, you know, when a property comes into our inventory, from trash out to, you know, ongoing maintenance, winterizations, you know, really doing all that we can to take care of the asset in a way that conforms to, if not conforms, even better than to properties that surround it. And so, you know, we don't want there. One of the things you constantly hear about in the industry is this REO stigma that exists, and that's one of those things we've been fighting for at least the last decade. Is, you know, just being a differentiator within the industry, where we don't want someone to turn down a street. I'm sure most, if not all of you, have had this experience where you turn down a street and you see a property that you can spot instantaneously that, oh, that's a foreclosure. Well, that's what we're trying to avoid. And so, you know, it's good for the neighbors, it's good for the community, and at the end of the day, it's really good for our overall return in minimizing severity and maximizing execution. And so as part of the maintenance side of the house, we also have multiple layers of QC. So we have brokers, a local assigned agent who's out there at the property on a weekly basis. We have third-party inspectors who are following up on all of our activities, and they send information to us real time. And then we have in-house teams that are out in the field. Of course, you know, COVID's changed a little bit of that here, at least in today's environment. But nonetheless, we still have regional expertise and folks both on the valuation side as well as people who support my team in and around those activities. We have, you know, just to coincide with that, we have diverse inspection products available. So it's not just about inspecting vacant properties. Again, we're always out at the property regardless of whether it's vacant, occupied, if we've just completed repairs, or if the property is ultimately within our rental pool. And then code compliance and vacant property registration. So the code compliance team, we stood this up a few years ago where, you know, a lot of properties that we acquire have existing code violations that, you know, we may have inherited, whether it's, you know, a tree that might be down on a fence or, you know, it could be something as small as trash in the yard. And so our team works with our vendor who works with the local municipalities in negotiating those fines down to an amount and addressing the issue, where since 2018 we've successfully reduced fines in excess of $50 million. And so I've had a lot of success in that. On the occupied property management side, Jake talked about this a little bit, but you know, we're pretty aggressive when it comes to what we call lockout avoidance, or this eviction as a last resort, where, you know, our objective is to do anything and everything we can to try to support that occupant in a graceful exit. And so whether that be through, you know, our preference would be through relocation assistance. You know, it's good for them and it's good for us, as well as, you know, we also leverage a occupied auction strategy. And so, and then we do market some properties that are tenant occupied as well. And so, again, you know, you know, today, I think it's about 5% of our properties that unfortunately do have to experience a lockout. But still, it's a very small proportion of the occupied properties that are in our inventory today. And then, you know, the last bullet here, so we do have, and this isn't just specific to Occupy Property Management, but we've got, you know, really robust in-house outsource model that we leverage, which is great, especially in light of potential influx in inventory at some point, you know, where we can easily absorb that without having to add additional headcount. And so we're really positioned well from that perspective. On the title and closing side of the house, you know, similar to our other vendors, we have both local and national attorney networks and suppliers that support all those activities. Again, flexible capacity model. We have an HOA and tax team, and so we do pay taxes on behalf. The servicer used to handle those for us, but we've taken all those activities in-house. The HOA team, since we started this program, and so in a lot of states, state by state, it's all different, but some states, you know, at post-foreclosure, we are only required to pay, you know, in some cases, 6 months of HOA dues. In other cases, you know, it's wiped clean. But you have a lot of HOAs who ultimately are seeking payment, and so our team works with the local HOAs to first off make that determination and then negotiate those HOAs down, where we've saved the company over $60 million in HOA dues. So we've had a lot of success in that area. And then the last thing here, in light of COVID, you know, we've had a lot of success from an e-closing perspective. In fact, my team, we set what we thought was a stretch goal for the year, and we've already blown that out of the water. And so I told my team to stop sandbagging, and it was time to set another goal for the year. And so, you know, we'll continue to leverage you know, that as an alternative for folks, and which is obviously, you know, is it perfect for today's environment. And then the last thing I'll call out here, the photos on the right are pretty self-explanatory, but the one that is a differentiator or big game changer for us is clearboarding. And so, you know, clearboarding is a product that, in fact, we were one of the first adopters of this some years ago, where, as you can see in the photo, nobody likes having a boarded up property using plywood. You know, clearboarding is really a strong plexiglass product that it's safe, it's secure, it's virtually unbreakable. And it obviously provides security to the home, while at the same time it helps from a curb appeal perspective, because you really can't tell that it's plexiglass as opposed to real glass in the property. And so that's been a like I said, a game changer for us, especially on those troubled assets that, you know, ultimately we're not looking to you know, to rehab, or we're looking to sell as is. And so if we go ahead and go to the next slide. Okay, so there's been a lot of focus, and rightfully so, on disaster response in light of events over the last few years, such as Hurricanes Maria, Harvey, Michael that hit Mexico Beach, as well. I mean, there's plenty of others in recent years. And so, you know, in regards to that response, you know, one of the things that's been pretty cool from our perspective in terms of addressing it is, you know, leveraging drone and aerial imagery. And so what you see here on the slide is, this is just some examples of the technologies that we leveraged in Maria. And so I'm sure all of you still remember, you know, one of the challenging things about Maria was we just couldn't gain access to the island. And even for those people that were on the island, it was extremely difficult to, you know, to travel across the island because of flooding, and you had, you know, downed power lines and what have you. And so, We did have, still had our, obviously we had our local agents, and we still had our local vendor in Safeguard, where, you know, at least we were able to leverage the aerial imagery and drone imaging to be able to determine those areas that we believe to be the highest impact. And so the heat mapping, you're able to tell which areas of the island were high, you know, had higher activity than others, and others that seemed to be kind of, you know, quiet zones or zones with little movement, and then we could overlay our properties that we had in those areas to determine, you know, where we needed to focus our resources. And so that was a huge asset for us. And then obviously you take that along with the aerial imagery, with being able to see which houses had tarps on the roofs and higher concentration of tarps. That further assisted us. And so this is, again, this is just a great example. It's something that we'll continue to use going forward in light of, you know, what we expect to see. In fact, this year is supposed to be a fairly active hurricane season. Hopefully so. Hopefully not. You know, but again, we're prepared for it nonetheless. All right, if you go ahead and move to the next slide. All right, this is one. Our repair strategy is one that I'm particularly super proud of. And in fact, I don't know if for those of you who may have made the last rating agency day, but typically I come with my props, and so it's a little disappointing to have to do this virtually when there's no ahs and oohs from the audience. But typically I come with my paint and carpet samples and my clearboarding, and it's almost like the Gallagher of Fannie Mae of sorts, if you will, although my wife wouldn't like me in long hair, but I digress. And so, you know, one of the things from a repair perspective, so I've been in the company for 16 years. We've always been repairing properties in REO for 16 years, at least 16 years I've been here. But what's been different is really up until a few years ago, our main focus was really about updating properties. And so when I say updating, it was, you know, paint and carpet. It was maybe a roof replacement, doing some simple carpentry work that may need to be done for a property to be eligible for financing, or some plumbing work that maybe needed to be done. Here today now, it's more than just updating. It's full-blown rehab where we're knocking down walls, we're reconfiguring properties, and really at the end of the day, you know, our mindset is that of an investor's mindset. And when I say an investor's, I'm talking about somebody who actually might acquire the property from us if we were to sell it as is, and just do the same that we're doing today. And so, in order to be successful in that, you have to have some great local expertise. And so, I mentioned our agent earlier; they are really our eyes and ears. But we also have, you know, local and national repair contractors that work with us. So we, you know, Jake talked a little bit earlier about our valuation products. And so once we have, you know, and for REO, we acquire, obtain an as-is, a repaired value, or both values, as well as an estimate of repairs. And so we have, so my REO team utilizes what we call Rhino. It's a proprietary investment modeling tool. So ultimately, you know, our values are fed into this tool along with, you know, home price appreciation and time value of money and all the and cost of capital. All this is factored in, and ultimately the tool provides a recommendation back to the asset manager as to whether or not that the tool believes it'd be prudent or in our best interest to repair. And so that's been a huge game changer for us. So in addition to Rhino, you know, we've got some other capabilities in the repair space that are really differentiators when compared to other peers in the industry. One is we just recently developed what we call a mobile scoping tool. And so what that is, you know, if you're going to have any work done to your own home and you're going to obtain a scope or two of repairs from a couple of contractors, well, we're doing the same, but obviously we're doing it on a much larger scale, and we're doing it all across the country. And so it's super challenging to do this. And so what we've done is we've developed a tool over the last year and a half, in conjunction with Richard Plotnick and his team, where, you know, we were able to do or have a scope of repairs completed real time at the property, where the agent, the contractor, and ourselves are able to leverage this same tool. And so, you know, it's very simple. It has our design boards that are embedded within the tool, and it has all of our pricing that's tied into it as well. And so, you know, looking forward to the efficiencies that we're going to gain as part of that. One of the other things, too, is, you know, considering how many properties we repair, you know, one of the nice things is we do have economies of scale because we buy a ton of material and we pay for a lot of labor. And so we've got preferred pricing with Home Depot and with others within our network that help us complete repairs at a lower cost than otherwise. And then from a repair perspective, we're also, I mentioned, you know, we've got some great alliances with Home Depot, but we're partnering with Whirlpool and some other vendors in the space where, you know, we're installing Nest thermostats to help promote energy efficiency, as well as installing water-saving products in our properties, where at the end of the day, you know, we're trying to reduce the ongoing burden of home ownership costs for what we're hoping to be is owner-occupant purchasers of our repaired properties. because statistically, 9 out of 10 of properties that we repair sell to an owner-occupant purchaser. And so we've had some great results in this space. You can see the before and after photos here. We could walk through examples. We've got thousands of these, but these were just a couple that I grabbed that thought were, just highlighted some of the great work that we're doing. And then at the end of the day, when we do repair, we want to make sure that we're showcasing and highlighting those repairs online, given that most buyers start their home purchase experience searching online. And so we leverage professional photography and then virtual staging for all of our repaired properties. If we go ahead and go to the next slide. So HomePath, I don't know if all of you have checked it out. There's obviously a recorded demo for HomePath as well as Community First, which is on the next slide. But HomePath.com, if you haven't been there, go check it out. It's our website that we use to market and sell all of our REO properties. Really this is, like Jake mentioned earlier, it's been a game changer for us. It's not to say that HomePath is the only place you can find our properties, because the site does syndicate out to all of the other major sites like Zillow, Realtor, Redfin, and the like. But again, anyone who's interested in finding out, whether it's more about our programs, whether it's, hey, I'm a home buyer, or I might want information on our financing products that are available. All of that's online, as well as our short sale portal as well. And then, one of the things that's really a differentiator for us compared to others in the industry is we do have online offer, which, that enables buyers' agents to submit offers directly to us to ensure that, because one of the things that you constantly hear, or we used to hear, we don't really hear it anymore, was, hey, how do you know my offer has been received? And so now we know with 100% certainty that every offer has been received. That's been a big advantage for us. If you go ahead and go to the next slide. And I'm just going to wrap up with this. And like I said, there's a recorded piece in the demo if you haven't checked it out already. So Community First, this is a new technology that we rolled out just towards the end of the year last year. And really what this is it's a website, kind of like HomePath, but better, that is targeted for nonprofits, community partners, as well as public entity purchasers, where they're able to go online, search for properties in their area that they may be interested in, express interest, negotiate with us or work with us in terms of pricing, and then they can complete the entire transaction online without the need to fill out any forms, sign anything. They can DocuSign right there, and then they have full transparency into the entire closing process, and all of that online without having to call an agent or, to call somebody else asking what the status is of their transaction. And so this has been huge for us. Again, we just recently rolled this out. We do see this as being kind of the future, if you will, of hopefully what we'll have for REO. But it's a really cool technology that we're pretty excited about. So with that, I think we are moving to Q&A. All right.
Great. Thank you. We'll open up the lines now for Q&A before we wrap up. So again, star one if you'd like to ask any questions for Jake or John. Okay. Well, it looks like we have no questions on this section. So just would like to wrap up. Thank you. We really appreciate you joining us today. Your engagement and flexibility as we shifted to this virtual format, and realized that nothing always goes perfectly with something new like this, but we do appreciate you following us and your participation. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, I hope this was able to give you a good overview of our end-to-end credit risk management platform and how we manage risk at a lender and loan level throughout the life of the loan. And I would definitely invite you to go deeper and take a look at the materials on our website. For those of you who have attended in person in the past, hopefully this session highlights the consistency of our core credit risk management practices and platform, and as well as some of the changes that we've made to drive innovation and digital transformation throughout our processes. And hopefully you could see this results in a very robust but flexible risk management platform. So with that, I would invite you to please take a moment and answer a short three-question survey that's available on, hopefully you'll see it, in the right panel of your screen. If you have any follow-up questions, please don't hesitate to reach out to us. You can either reach out directly to me, this is Laurel Davis, Kathleen Pagliaro, or any other members of the CAS team, or to Sonia Bobian's team over in Investor Marketing. And so with that, I would like to conclude our program and wish you a good rest of your day. Thank you all, and you may now disconnect the line.